The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this awful, just the worst named podcast in the history of podcasts. But the QA, that's the important part, because we're going to have a great conversation, kicking our week off, getting that energy up. This is exactly why I like to hold my podcast on a Monday, get that kind of feedback, some of the news stories that have hit from the last week. I took 2 weeks where in the middle of, or I should say the end of Techtober, reviews were just cranking. Like, I don't know that I've ever worked harder at keeping up with production work. I had a casting gig come in out of nowhere for a voiceover project. That was crazy. Some hosting gigs, and then putting out more videos in the last 2 weeks than I think I've done in that kind of work frame in a while. And I was waking up this morning, just kind of going over some news feeds, trying to like put together the blog post. And it's been 2 weeks of just being a little off my normal flow. I've completely forgotten the normal structure of my podcast looks like. So I'm going to try and get back to having a little bit more of a, you know, going through housekeeping, the news block, getting back to plugging the subreddit. We haven't talked about the subreddit in like 3 weeks, and the subreddit is doing really well. It's been a lot. It really has been. We talked about this a bit on Best of Our Week, the show that TK and I do on Thursdays. And, I gotta say, like, I'm exhausted, but this has been the best Techtober I've personally been through in probably 3 years. Just the combination of gadgets that have come down, some of the announcements, some of the releases, knowing that we're getting into the holiday buying season. This is the most fun I've had in a while. And, you know, I get real cranky. I mean, my reviews are always really persnickety and very snarky. But I'm trying to not let that aspect of me kind of overshadow the fact that if you're really into tech, you're not just, you know, like a fan of one brand. This has been awesome. Like, this has genuinely just been the most fun I've had in a while. So I'm already seeing a tremendous group in the live chat. I see Dave Burns, Gabaletta, Gary the Fireman just popping in. Hey, what's up? Kappa Cash, Streamy Boys, Squishy Man 2007, Aditya Anil, Otaku, Simon Says Hypno, Sveticus? No, I am Sveticus. The Hawks TV, Mr. Malignance. I'm missing Vazicose. Slick Rick Moranis should not be watching. Slick Rick Moranis should be celebrating his honeymoon. I need everyone in the live chat to throw a huge thumbs up of glory and congratulations to Slick Rick. Hopefully he's not even watching anymore. Like, I already admonished him, go do honeymoon. Streamy boys, I like the snark. Keep up the snark. So, I mean, part of the thing is, we had a conversation about this on the Discord. As we're getting into the end of the year, like, mental health and exhaustion and still trying to survive life in the midst of a global pandemic, I can definitely feel when I'm going from snarky to mean. And there are times where I cannot help myself. And I've got to recognize that in myself and pull myself back from that ledge. And that's genuinely, like, even with all the excitement and all the cool stuff and all the fun things, it's like I can feel the stress of getting everything done kind of leading me to some conclusions that I really wouldn't enjoy. I really feel would do a disservice to all the products I'm talking about and wouldn't be good for the community, right? Like, if we're kind of not upfront and honest about, like, the toll, the human toll of getting through all of this content and making all of this commentary and trying to participate, not just lazily throwing out some pretty B-roll, but genuinely, like, the amount of effort it takes, you can see it on a channel like TK Bays. That man, I don't understand how he manages his workflow, because he cranks out so much incredible deep dive content. He just doesn't have the prettiest B-roll. You can see that there's a specific and a marked difference in the quality of his conversation versus the production value of his final videos. And it's not to say that he makes poor-looking videos. I mean, I kind of feel we are contemporaries in a focus on performance and deep diving and granular settings versus trying to make something cinematic. Neither of us are into cinematic. We're both really into editorial and a more sort of a metered or consistent approach to tech reviewing. And TK Bay is in the chat. Hey TK, I'm saying nice things about you right now. So really it's just kind of getting back from letting things get toxic. You know, it's definitely something that the tech community has on their minds, and I think we're also sort of acknowledging that there's a shrinking effect happening in tech enthusiasm. We're going to start off this podcast just a little heavy so that then we can kind of lighten things up, and especially getting into Gadget Block and talking about Pixel 6 and some of my experiences with Duo 2 and spending a little bit more quality time with the Vivo. I've got a lot of more fun thoughts. So why don't we kind of front load some of the mental health things here? Like, there was recently a Twitter thread from Jason, Painfully Honest Tech, just talking about what a brutal toll it is on his psyche to open up his YouTube creator account and see his stats dropping every month. You know, I have to work my butt off on SEO and backend and only talking about the most popular things. And I'm still seeing red arrows, right? I'm not really supposed to show you all of, like, the CPM and the money and the watch time and all this other metric data. That's supposed to be proprietary information between me and YouTube. But let me just tell you, working harder than I've ever worked before, I'm making way less on YouTube, and my watch time, subscriber count, view time, clicks, tags, the amount of times my videos are shared has never been lower, right? So when we wrap all of these things up in the amount of effort it takes, and it's hard not to take that kind of stuff personally, right? We want to say, hey, we're in it for this fun and we want to be a part of this community, but there's something sort of decaying or shrinking in how this community is handled. We're not replenishing our ranks with new members. People generally aren't as interested in the overall sort of tech vibe as a conversation. And increasingly, the platforms are pointing people to only the biggest channels. And I feel like that is a a perfect recipe for a Facebook-style implosion of our hobby. I mean, if we really are into tech and not just saying nice things about Apple because it makes you more money, we need to be very concerned about the direction all of this is heading. It's increasingly impossible to have sort of, you know, niche or hobbyist kinds of communities in light. So again, I always appreciate when people say like, hey, don't let the haters get you down, or don't worry, you just keep talking about the things you like. You don't always have to do the media literacy thing or pick apart other bad reviewers. I kind of do. I genuinely love this overall conversation as my hobby. And I feel like I need to protect it, not by being a gatekeeper keeping other people out, but by trying to show what I find is problematic and to try and get more people in. Because I feel like anyone out there around the world who's not sort of, you know, been ordained by owning one of the most expensive and most popular gadgets is going to look at our community and say like, yeah, but they're only in it to say nice things about Galaxy Ultras and iPhone Pro Maxes. You know, like, and I own a $300 mid-ranger, and so I've got to go find some crazy pocket community of, like, super diehard Poco fans, right? You know, like, if we're really not living that inclusive lifestyle in this conversation, then our sort of our little pocket of nerds at the lunch table, you know, talking about geeky stuff is really going to wither. Google has no interest in promoting that kind of a conversation without clicks and shares and views. And so what are we left with? And what we're left with is not something I find to be all that fun. So, yeah, I mean, Simon says Hypno. I mean, Jason really put himself out there. I mean, like, I had to give that an instant retweet because I think he spoke very personally about some of the issues that, I mean, I've been trying to address on this podcast, that I've been hearing from numerous other creators, especially people who I don't feel would want me outing them. But you can feel like a number of other creators and reviewers and some of the old guard have definitely been struggling with the transitions we've seen over the last 3 years, 4 years, somewhere in there. So it's heady stuff. But again, it's why I feel, especially in a core group like this, like, you know, I'm seeing the names, the regular names and faces in this chat, and I'm definitely preaching to the choir. But, you know, for anyone who might stumble onto this or who might consider participating, it's why I feel you see this kind of passion. It seems alien when you encounter it. Like, why is this person so upset? Or why is this person getting so angry? Or why are all these rants popping out about this person who's got, you know, this huge YouTube channel? I mean, obviously he earned it through pure meritocracy and the grind. And, you know, why can't we just celebrate the successes of the very, very few in this community? And it, as you dig into it, I feel it's understood, but it's hard to get that message across without sounding like you're just whining or that it's just sour grapes. Look, I'm hosting this podcast on Twitch. You know, like, I feel I could probably get a few more eyeballs on it if I, you know, sucked it up and just went back to YouTube for the mainstream. But like, there's a reason. You know, I'm trying to live the change I want to see in the world. So I just saw TK Bay is going crazy, gifting tier one subs. TK Pay gifted to Kui J, Simply Your Device, Muppinish, June Boriqua, and Joker Royalty. TK, you're silly and I love you, and that's awesome. Thank you so much again, production, supporting and you know, contributing and joining these conversations. Always all the love, and thank you very much. Dave Burns has a comment here to highlight that I'd like to get to. The race to the bottom for YouTube content promotion kills everything because it's the most profitable for YouTube content quality, be damned. I'm really trying not to take off. Is it that I want to put on my tinfoil hat or take off my tinfoil hat? Okay. I went down, you know, like, creepy YouTube rabbit hole. I love ARGs and I love spooky media. And I love like short horror. You know, someone with a smartphone and a creepy mask wants to make a 2-minute jump scare. I'm all for it. I love it so much. And I love, you know, like ARG media that twists your perception of the world around you and makes you like question if the shadow in your bedroom at night is really just, you know, like a sweater hanging up on a hook or something like that. I just adore it. But one of the videos I went down is the dead internet theory. And I don't really buy it, but it hangs on the notion that Google is basically like a Potemkin village. It's a total fake set, a facade, and that the internet is literally dying under the weight of social media and algorithmic sorting of content, and it's basically impossible to create, you know, like a little blog and have people come and visit it. And, you know, from the death of RSS feeders and stuff like that to the rise of services like Reddit, we're basically seeing this shrinking and this amplification effect of recycled media, right? You go to Reddit and you're going to see the same memes over and over and over and over and over again, reshared and reshared and reshared, and that an overwhelming majority of this content push is coming from bots and from algorithms and from software, not from real people really trying to make and create things. And like the people who think, when was the last time I really went to a website to just see what was new on that website and discover something versus, you know, sort of clicking like on a thumbnail on a social media platform, and that's like the extent of my interaction with that piece of media. So I've just been going deep on stuff like that because I feel there's a sentiment that's correct there. I don't necessarily believe that the theory as presented in this video was on the level. And so much of the video is just these vague feelings of like, well, when was the last time you did this? And doesn't that feel like the internet is completely dead? And you're like, well, that's not a great way to frame an argument, but I do feel like this is bad. So, I think a lot of the, you know, like someone emailed me directly and was like, hey, I really feel like you're letting these other content creators live in your head rent free. And the flip side of that is I feel a number of reviewers my size and smaller have been talking about the review practices more. And I think we're seeing some of these channels that can be problematic in the presentation of their information and the way that their reviews are guided by profitability on algorithms are starting to get defensive. I feel like they're trying to address how the sausage is made. And I think that's a good thing because we should be airing this laundry out more. So hopefully that's a step that we can point to as positive change, you know, addressing these issues, talking about them and bringing them to light, while we also try to talk about like creator burnout and sort of the, that vice grip feeling of like, oh, I've got to make this and I've got to do that and I've got to do this and I've got to, you know, I've got to make 5 thumbnails for every video so that when I put the video up after 5 minutes, I can change the thumbnail and that's going to trick the algorithm into trying to send it out to more people. And then I can do this and revise that. And you're like, I shouldn't have to do all that. If someone subscribed to my channel, the algorithm should point them to some of my content. And that's kind of the big bummer. Let's get through some of these comments, and then we're going to knock out some housekeeping here. JMX Warrior just bought his mom a Xiaomi Mi 11 Lite 5G. That is such a pretty phone. I never got to play with the 5G version, but the LTE version, like I even sent it to a couple other like Geezer Talks Tech. Like, I just want to show that phone to people. Like, here's this really inexpensive, you know, like perfect level of price performance, good cameras, but the build is just so pretty. And especially like I pulled my Mi 11i back out also, where just like the power button, fingerprint sensor, all these little Xiaomi touches are spot on. I really like the direction their hardware is going right now. Scrolling down. I mean, you know, you can also say it in the way that I always say it. Kappa Cash writes, they're quick to mention the average consumer, but never talk about the tech they use. I'm talking to TK Bay about some of the other content that we're putting out, and we need to do a trade. I'm just about done with some of my samples and audio recordings and stuff for the Duo 2, and I want TK to play with the Duo 2. We did an exchange with the Note versus the Duo 1, and when it comes to productivity hardware, like, TK is, again, he's one of those voices that I really feel people should be listening to more often. He's so much kinder about his commentary than I am. But we're talking about kind of doing another trade. I think one of the things that maybe guys like TK and I should be more upfront about. I listened to a massive YouTuber talk about using a phone during an embargo week on pre-release software for 5 days, and I took 4 whole samples from the camera, and the UI was stuttery because it's, you know, beta software. It's not what the consumer is really going to use, but average consumers should be concerned and they shouldn't buy this phone. And to your point, Cup of Cash, like, what did they use on the phone? Like, my app list is silly big now. Audio editing software, motion graphics software, keyframing software, 2 different video editors, 3 sometimes if I work in like one of the free editors like VN. That's just on the content creation side. I've got plugins for my audio editing. I've got now Rode for my mics and my wireless to manage what's going on there. And that's before I get into office and document solutions. That's before I get into file compression, photo editing. I've got 3 different apps that I'm using now for photo editing. And then games, like a ton of games. So what kind of commentary, what kind of value should we put on commentary that is talking about the average consumer, and yet we never see them do anything on their phones? They're not using their phones for anything that we can see. It's so minimal. And if, like, the only thing that we're gonna talk about average for average consumers is, like, it should be able to use social media, your email, texting, and, like, have a camera that puts out good color. Yeah, like, that's handled at $200. That's average. That's the baseline. That is the lowest common denominator. We can all agree a phone should be able to do this. And why would you spend $1,000 to achieve that? You shouldn't. You should never. But I've been mixing it up in the mobile journalism forums and subreddits. I've been mixing it up in the filmmaker. There's a smartphone filmmaker subreddit. And one of the guys there who like legit posts a ton of videos. I mean, his videos get very little traffic. And I try to occasionally like cross post to Glowing Rectangles. But we start talking about like, well, yeah, I could buy a mirrorless camera for like $700. You're like, not with a lens, not with, you know, batteries, power management, memory cards, your tripod's going to be more expensive, your mounts, your rigs, all of your accessories are going to be pricier. You could start with the phone and genuinely compete very, very well these days if you wanted to cut a short film. You know, like, this isn't that hard, but it's never an oranges to oranges. It's like, yeah, but I got this full-frame camera body used with a ton of shutter actuations on it for $500. What $500 phone can compete with the full-frame camera? And I want to be like, every phone, because you didn't get a lens for $500. So let's really start adding all this stuff up. Anyway, I've digressed. TK Bay. We love your face, TK. yeah, I'm so happy to hear this. Riviera613, +1 for our Glowing Rectangles, which has helped me find so many good producers. I mean, I love hearing that. The mission of the subreddit is discovery. It's about promoting, even self-promoting. I'm, you know, that warms my soul. I want so many of these, especially the up-and-coming creators, to find some kind of audience or some kind of visibility. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is big truth energy right here, Squishy Man. You got to clear the energy from the room and the space. I'm as obnoxiously, agnostically atheistic as they come, but one of the things I've always held true, from doing theater in college, doing TV production, working on films, that like, man, the emotions that get built up in a room that you've spent some time in with some other creative individuals gets intense. And it's hard to walk away, and it's addictive, and you get those highs and you get those lows, and it's all the drama, and sometimes you just gotta open a window, set up a fan, and just kind of blow all that stuff out. This is terrible metaphors, but it's legit. Like, you've gotta feel that from time to time. You know what? Why don't I'm still catching up. Yeah, McCorcoran 3, this is also very true too. We need that TK Bay bobblehead, especially with Epic Beard. Epic Beard Energy bobblehead. We totally need that. I love it. And we'll get into housekeeping now. DGNL, these are not the Geekbench scores you are looking for. Obi-Wan Kenobi. Hey. Oh, and I'm sorry, I gotta highlight just one more here from McCorcoran. Even like a $60 Samsung A10e was the best-selling Android phone in the first quarter of 2020. It has like 2 gigabytes of RAM. This is another thing that I'm trying not to take overly personal because I can't contribute as directly, but I feel there's a message that's getting lost. Like, I recently just reviewed the new Infinix. It's like a sub-$300 phone. And how much phone you can get for under $300 is absolutely incredible. And that, to me, in a more privileged Western reviewer space, like, I could drop $400 on a phone, buy it, walk out the door. I'm in a good position for that. Like, it's not, it's that to me is a reasonable purchase. And if I understand what I'm buying, I'm good. Yeah, $400 for a lot of people around the globe is way outside their budget, way outside their means, and what they're trying to buy is literally going to be their only compute device. I am flush with monitors and a TV and a laptop and a TV downstairs and my wife's laptop and this killer desktop. And why would just anyone use their phone for things, right? Why don't you just use your $10,000 workstation, right? I mean, like average consumers do. And that's not average. Again, I'm trying not to make this like the cause, right? I still want to talk about the fun of everything, but like, I feel one of the reasons why we're watching our tech community shrink is because we're kind of off the pulse. When Galaxy S sales are tanking, but Galaxy A sales are skyrocketing, maybe we do need to refocus our conversation on how we talk about premium tier gadgets and what it is that they really afford consumers out there. I genuinely feel, ever since the Pixel 3a came out in North America, I really feel that's been our baseline. So much of my family are now on sub $500 phones. My wife is on the Pixel 4a 5G. My dad is on the Pixel 4a because he doesn't care about 5G. My sister and her husband are on Pixel 3As. My brother is on a Moto E. So he was on a Pixel for a while. I've been talking about like my family and stuff, but he broke his Pixel 3a. And you know what? Replacing the Pixel 3a was going to be a little too expensive because, he doesn't treat his phones very kindly and he breaks all of them. So he went and got like the cheapest Moto E that he could get his hands on. And you know what? I mean, like, I feel like that was the right fit for him. My mom is still on her OnePlus 6T. And I don't know what she's going to go to. I think she's looking at Pixels, like the Pixel A series, like the Pixel 5. She got to see the Pixel 5. She came to visit for Lex's birthday. And she was looking at that. I think she's concerned that, like a Pixel 6 is now even bigger than the phone that she currently has. So I'm going to be curious. At some point, I think I might just have to like fly my mom out again and just be like, hey, spend a couple days and you can use any of the phones that I currently have in house and see what you like.
because you know, I'm not sure she'll love some of the design changes on the new OnePluses, but she kind of likes having a phone that's not like everyone else's. And so for me, I think like Pixel could be kind of a good fit for that. So we'll have to see. Hold on, let me catch up on just these, and then I'll blitz through housekeeping. We're a half hour in. I haven't even made it to housekeeping. I am so off my game for hosting a podcast. This is hilarious. Oh yeah, Simon says Hypno. Those Pocos, the F3 Pro is available for £239 this week. Insane value. That is so much phone for £240. That is just a crazy amount of phone. I get. From McCorkerin 3. So we've talked about this a bit. So and that's really interesting because your wife could obviously use an expensive phone if she wanted to. She gets more joy out of the less expensive ones. I've tried ever since the LG G7. She kind of peaked. That was like the last like premium grade phone that she spent some time with, and she even managed to kind of break the G7. Ever since then, like, she's been fine for compute power. She doesn't care if her phone is more powerful. She wants better battery life, and she kind of wants to stay at the same tier but pay less. And to me, like, that just speaks to so many consumer concerns. They don't need better graphics. They don't need better performance at the expense of battery life. And so she's rocking a Pixel 4a 5G. She loves it. The camera is great. It gets very good battery life. And if she were to flip a phone today, she'd probably end up on a Pixel 5a just for the slightly nicer phone build quality. But she'd still probably throw a big old chunky OtterBox case on it. Let's see. It's from Sveticus. Can you discuss how hot the Pixel 6 Pro gets compared to the S21? I hear some mixed reports about heat management with the Tensor. So, Sveticus, hold on to that. When we get to the second half after the subreddit plug, we're going to talk a lot about Pixel 6. There's the new teardown from Hugh Jeffries, the rumors on the Pixel Fold. Please bring that back up because I do want to address some of my concerns just in general, because I think this has been an interesting or a tricky year for SoC design. And then from Aditya, so basically Juan's brother is your everyday Joe who occasionally drops their phones and does not have the luxury of shipping their foldable to Australia to have its screen replaced. I think my brother is a little tougher on his phones than the average Joe. I mean, he has destroyed phones through taking them on long bike rides because he just sweated through them. He wrecked a nicer Motorola way back in the day because he soaked through the phone. Like there was liquid under the screen. He had an Honor for a while and he smashed the screen on that. I mean, he's just, you know, it's not to say like, oh, he's careless. He doesn't take care of his things. I think he just appreciates that, like, in the midst of focusing on everything else in his life, the one thing that he can't sit and focus and baby and take time out of his day to manage is his phone. So why spend a lot if he knows that this primary communications device for him is very limited use? I mean, it's phone calls and emails. He does very little texting. He doesn't video call. When he needs to set things up like that, he has a nicer laptop, or I think his girlfriend also uses a tablet that they've talked on. You know, those kinds of things. Why spend all the mental energy of trying to, like, oh no, I've got this really expensive gadget that I've got to be ultra careful with? It's outside his sphere of consideration. So he's gonna kind of rock something cheap. You know, again, I'm trying to be careful not saying like, oh, this is my brother doesn't take care of his things, but I think his focus is very specific on what he needs to take care of. So I'm going to take a quick drink of coffee here. I'm going to be really curious. Yeah, a bunch of people are mentioning the new Poco. I'm going to be very curious to see what they release because, you know, we're seeing a brutally competitive market sliding down to like the $300 tier and that roughly $300 tier. And like we just said, if you could wait just a minute, like the F3 goes on sale for ridiculously low prices and is a beast of a phone. A phone from last year, if you can kind of hang with a little less software support, is just a stupid powerful, a premium phone from last year is a stupid powerful gadget. You know, like here in the United States, you can pick up a V60 and you can pick up I've seen the V60 in that $300 range, like refurbed and new, sub $400. And like, that is just such a tank of a phone and is such a unique mini tablet gadget. Like that's nuts. So yeah, I mean the entire conversation I feel needs to be reshifted to ever increasing price performance competition. Okay, I have not done a housekeeping in a while. There's been a ton of stuff that I'm putting out, so I'm really just going to focus on the last week. But I do want to say, if you haven't checked in on somegadgetguide.com for a while, that's probably the best place just to kind of catch the thread on everything that I've been producing. So just going into a screen share here real quick for a second. Obviously, the biggie last week was getting out a two-week sort of review on the Pixel 6 Pro. We're going to talk about this more in the second half of the podcast, but this is really the video I want to start a conversation on this phone. Anyone who's acting like they can make a purchasing decision conclusion is bad at tech. So there you go. I also got a review out on the NeoBuds Pro. These came out, I think, 3 months ago. But I really am excited because this is a good cost-conscious pair of premium earbuds. You know, they land between $100 and $150 depending on sales and sort of those coupon codes that you can find on Amazon. But the thing I'm excited about is for these being sort of cost-conscious for high-techy earbuds, the company, Edifier, has done a very good job of living up to their promise getting software support out. So they launched with only one high-res codec, and they promised, oh yeah, and we are going to get LDAC out, and they did. They got LDAC out in 2 months, which is phenomenal. These are a great, great bang for buck, and the manufacturer is keeping up with support. One of the written articles, Microsoft Surface Duo 2 by the benchmarks, getting more done faster. The Duo 2, happily, one of the most powerful phones, gadgets, tablets of the year. And I've got a full breakdown, the creator benchmarks, you know, file compression, all that fun stuff, photo editing, blah, 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 blah. It is a little tricky to benchmark a Duo 2 because the design of the Duo 2 is either you have two screens going, so there's additional power draw on one screen, or you wrap the screen behind so that it's in like a single screen view, but this literally, where the heat generating components are, this can literally trap heat in between the panels of the Duo 2. So I'm a little conflicted on, just like I was for the V60, you know, like LG's dual display, like how do I talk about battery life on a phone that is gonna be used with two screens? My screen on time is not one screen, it's screen on time for two screens most of the time and one screen some of the time. So how do I factor in battery life on something like that? And same thing for performance testing, like how do I weight, you know, the performance of something that is genuinely designed to do two things at the same time? And it's just kind of a head trip. But if you want to see the scores in the way that I mostly tested in a single screen fashion, that link is available now on somegadgetguy.com. And then I also had to put out an editorial, Sony Xperia Pro I camera, why is this so good? Because the Sony camera apps are just so stinking good. And I'm so tired of kind of lazy tech reviewers. Oh, but Sony's are so complicated because you have three apps and who could use this? While they shoot all their B-roll on Sony Alpha cameras. Anyone complaining is bad at tech and bad at photography. It's okay to say it's different, and it's okay to say, you know, like, hey, from a personal preference, I would prefer these things to be in one app. And actually, I think there is a good argument for how Sony could combine some of these apps to improve on some of the, you know, usage or discoverability. But the core idea of a Sony is to focus on content creation. The software is designed to empower you to make the best stuff you can in that moment. So I did a video a while back on the Pixel 5a, because I feel like the Pixel is sort of the opposite conversation. A Pixel is all about streamlined point and shoot, ease of use, and getting the user to focus on simply composing a shot with like the easiest management of all of the settings in one camera app. Funnily enough, I think a Sony is actually the best partner to that conversation, where both phones do the best job of focusing the user on their content. They just do it in polar opposite kinds of ways. One with a focus on more professional grade control and image manipulation, the other on the best implementation of full auto. And so I want these two videos to kind of mirror each other. Going from a Pixel 5a to a Sony Xperia Pro I, we're literally bookending the target demographics, the price, performance, everything is as opposite as it can be, but we kind of get to the same idea. Get out of the way of the user and empower them to focus on their composition. And I think that's brilliant. But we've got to get through a whole bunch of try-hard reviewers that can't understand different things. Why isn't everything like an iPhone? But if it were more like an iPhone, we'd complain about them copying the iPhone. But it's unfamiliar. But don't copy. But make it the same. Which is dumb. Dustin Dorr. I'm sorry. I know I'm kind of ignoring the comments here for a bit. Everyone say hey to Barry Johnson, just kind of in lurking mode right now. This one caught my eye and just gave me a chuckle. But one, the Duo 2 camera bump stops you from using all of that SoC's power. I mean, how can you even use it now that it's got a little bit of a bump? They should have made it just flush.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r/glowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Dave, whoa, stop pointing out my hypocrisy. All right. So all of the links and the show notes, everything that we're going to be talking about, you're going to find that on the blog post page for this week's episode, somegadgetguide.com. Let me get this out of the way here. We're going to also run very quickly through some of the news. Politics light. I'm trying to talk, you know, with reviews.org about coming up with a better strategy for covering like FCC news. Like, I think a quarterly recap on the FCC and FTC news is probably a good balance so that we're not overwhelming the reviews.org audience. And then kind of, I don't want to move people to different channels and, hey, follow me on YouTube for this and go read this reviews.org article for that. But it's also like, I know I make way too much stuff. So if you want to hear me kind of yell at you every day, you can do that. But I'm trying to find where it's appropriate to have each conversation and how much of that we should kind of load on people. So this article kind of came up, something to keep an eye on, because I feel some of the promises of our telecoms need to be examined over time. It's really exciting when you find some millimeter wave 5G on Verizon and you see like 2 gigabit downloads, but you can only get them if you hold perfectly still. So an article like this pops up, and obviously I don't think anyone would dispute me on this, that AT&T's rollout I think has been disappointing for how slow and ponderous their rollout has been. But we also need to take in a lot of infrastructure into consideration. This is written up by John Fingus over at Engadget. AT&T and Verizon will delay 5G expansion over aircraft safety issues. The FAA is worried about interference with cockpit systems. So you'll have to hear from the article. You may have to wait a while to take advantage of C-band, 5G's potentially higher speeds. The Wall Street Journal has learned that AT&T and Verizon are delaying their C-band rollouts by at least a month to help the FAA address aircraft interference concerns. Had originally planned to use the newly available frequencies on December 5th, but AT&T said it was pushing its launch to January 5th after the Transportation Department requested a delay. There's a lot going on. And the reason why I feel like that's kind of a bummer for people on Verizon and AT&T, as we talk about expanding signal, improving coverage, better frequencies. The reason why I feel like that is going to kind of put a bit of a hurt on folks. Airports are one of those high traffic areas where people genuinely would benefit from enhanced spectrum and from additional frequencies and better coverage. The reason why I get excited about millimeter wave isn't because it's a good solution for residential or it's going to, you know, help replace home broadband. It's a terrible option for all of those, but it is kind of cool when you're like in a high traffic or a high population density area to have different tiers of spectrum and connection to kind of move people around and not overly bogged down one kind of tower. You saw people on just straight up LTE, on sub-6, on millimeter wave. You can move more broadcast to some of those expanded high frequency channels. If you're in a stadium, you know, like it makes sense to have millimeter wave there. The bummer is like how much more we've got to pay for those phones for good millimeter wave support on a feature that is dubious anyone will be able to use, many people will be able to use in its current incarnation. If you bought a millimeter wave phone last year, how much have you really gotten to use millimeter wave on your phone? For the vast majority of the people spending more on millimeter wave phones, that's not a thing. So this C-band rollout, again, one of those places we would really want that expansion are places where travel, data communication, it's the area you most need, you know, the consistency or the reliability of your phone. I need messages coming in. I need to be able to pull up my boarding pass and all my travel and accommodations and message this and phone call that. So this is kind of we want this rollout. We want better communication tools. We want improved service. This is one of the primary areas where we would want it. And now it's going to slow us down just a little. Moving right along, one of the things that might help improve signal and coverage, this was not on my radar. And now I'm going to have to pitch a story to reviews.org because we've been covering Starlink. I did not know that Boeing was in the running for a broadband satellite constellation. So there was a Reuters story about this updated about a month ago. Boeing is seeking approval for a satellite constellation, kind of like Starlink's, more of a low Earth orbit solution. And it looks like the FCC has just now authorized Boeing to start to launch and operate a non-geostationary satellite orbit system in the fixed satellite service. This could be kind of a big deal. So we've been talking about Starlink and just trying to expand what other options we have for competition in broadband, especially in more rural areas that are harder to string literal cables from home to home. Or find other sort of more terrestrial solutions like fixed home internet on LTE connections. it can be challenging. It can be kind of a problem. And so just shooting stuff up into space for a certain chunk of the population might make more sense. Seeing anyone else enter the space where we could have another potential, you know, sort of global solution, and then something that, you know, especially when we talk about satellite, might be a better communication standard for aircraft, could be kind of a big deal. So I just started reading up on this. I have no idea what Boeing's full plan, if this is going to be consumer facing, if it's maybe going to be more business facing. They launch up and maintain these satellites, and then other people lease access based on their industry. Regardless, this is very interesting to see sort of an organization like Boeing trying to step into this space. Hold on, I got to take a drink of coffee here. From Dave Burns, again, and there are these kinds of concerns too. On its face, this seems like a good thing, but I'm honestly furious that we have to send satellites into low orbit because our government is incompetent. You know, it's kind of like energy concerns and, oh, no, I mean, this is totally true. He adds, we have paid for fiber to home something like four times over and we shouldn't have to do this. Completely agree. Especially on the fiber to home things, you know, like on fees and taxes and sweetheart deals to telecoms, like we should all have fiber to home. This is just insanely silly at this point that we're even pretending that like DSL is still a competitive, comparable service for that price. And cable is just horrifically asymmetrical. It's all about consuming content for cable companies. It's not about participating or sending content back up in a 21st century economy that depends on us being able to do that. But the reason why I'm kind of interested, you know, fiber to home and other terrestrial solutions are necessary. But we do have infrastructure problems with rural citizens. And then we also need to start having those conversations about revamping, you know, in-flight communication. This is a two or three generation long problem. Not problem, but two or three generation evolution of how we get planes talking to the ground, talking to each other, sharing data and information. Just like we saw, you know, our terrestrial concerns with 5G could influence or impact how airplanes and communications are managed. This takes a long time, you know, how we retrofit or how we build new aircraft is going to be influenced by our future data needs and data concerns. And this is why I kind of feel satellite needs to be examined critically, but we need to offer some type of celestial solution for maintaining communications. So I completely agree with the sentiment, but this is also why I feel like this one just, we need to watch, we need to keep an eye on. And everyone say hey to Tech Loving Mama. She just jumped into the chat. She's good people, so I need everyone to give her a wave. So more news to come. I'm going to start digging into Boeing a little bit more because, like I said, that one completely surprised me. This is another one just in terms of, you know, like how a service gets built up, becomes popular, and then needs to be refined over time. I thought this was just an interesting change of policy. And I don't know what the ramifications of it will be. But, you know, when we talk about things like crowdfunding, there's often a buyer beware. I've promised to contribute to numerous crowdfunding campaigns. Some of them felt like scams and then they just missed their deadlines, but I still got a cool product. Some of them just never materialized. You're like, oh, well, it's a good thing my credit card was never charged. Indiegogo is doing something kind of interesting where I forget when it's going to start. I lost it. In this is the actual press release. This is from the Indiegogo blog. But basically what they're going to start doing is verifying projects, and they're going to be overhauling their trust and safety team. So hopefully stemming some of the issues with crowdfunding, but then putting a bit more of a burden on crowdfunding participants to properly guide how their projects are launched and how those projects are managed. And it looks like they're going to even start trying to come up with ways to score so that, you know, let's say someone is constantly using Indiegogo as a platform for kicking off new product ideas. You can kind of vet how effective they've been at previous projects. It's interesting. Like, I'm not sure what the effectiveness of that will be, but I think increasingly when we look at crowdfunding platforms like, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo, it's either someone who gets in there with the best of intentions, but they can't pull off what they promised. So that's a bummer. Then there are people who are just outright scammers, and it's really difficult to suss who's just a straight up scammer and who was someone who failed at delivering, right? Like, I feel that deserves a distinction, even though ultimately you end up with a frustrated backer at the end of that process. But then I also think that there are a number of companies and people out there that are looking at these crowdfunding platforms just as promotion. And I don't know that that's bad, but I also wonder, you know, doesn't that take away from some of the mission of a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo? Here's a company that could probably finance and build their product. They probably don't need to crowdfund, but they're using that as sort of a launching point to amp up the social media. They can talk about all of their successes. We hit our funding goal in like 3 days. There's obviously a lot of buzz and a lot of consumer demand for this product, and we can use those tech headlines to kind of push a narrative. It's savvy, but it feels manipulative. So I'm not sure what the feeling on that is. I don't think their changes, Indiegogo's changes to their sort of verification or trust committee are going to address all of that. But I do think it's interesting, especially now, and especially getting into year two of a global pandemic, or getting through year two of a global pandemic, that this is the time that Indiegogo feels that they need to address some of those concerns. So it's gonna be interesting to watch. I think it's a critical aspect of watching this grow in our society, how we contribute money to individuals, to companies. And through these kinds of platforms, increasingly, the platform is going to be responsible for the needs of the consumers who participate. Excuse me. Oof, that was kind of a bad one. Like burps are gross. Hold on, let me drink more coffee. Woohoo! So, I appreciate them joining and contributing to that part of the conversation. And now I kind of need to see, like, what impact does this actually have on people using their platform? Aditya, I can't wait for Apple to ask for crowdfunding to make wired earphones. Russ, Apple should reinvent the headphone jack and all should follow. I agree. It is still dumb to take a wonderfully useful analog audio jack off of a mobile communications device. And I love that pro means having a really nice headphone jack on a laptop, but pro does not mean having a nice headphone jack on a phone or a tablet. And then lastly, for the news block, just to kind of squish this one in there, another one from John Fingus, doing some great journalism on the tech scene, tech community from Engadget. Who has any faith in Meta/Facebook? I really feel the name is tainted no matter what, and consumer concerns are high, and the company's operating practices are like the worst possible in the current criticism of social media. So I get Facebook is shutting down its face recognition system. Public backlash plays a role. This is published on Engadget. Meta is further backing away from facial recognition. The company has announced it's shutting down the face recognition system on Facebook in, quote, the coming weeks. You'll no longer be automatically recognized in photos if you opted into the feature, and the Facebook team will delete over 1 billion facial recognition templates automatic alt text descriptions for the visually impaired will also stop naming people detected in photos. So this is good, but this is completely unfair of me. I'm gonna go off on just my feelings. Facebook has demonstrated no honorable intentions in any of their products, services, maintaining promises. I have no faith that this is just the sort of stopping point of a process on Facebook monetizing user behavior and user data, and that at some point something else will happen, or we'll find, hey, just because we didn't publicly tag you in a photo doesn't mean that we haven't been operating, improving algorithms on search and face and, you know, identifiable information. When we see an effort, I want to say, like, hey, that's the right move, Facebook. Don't be so scummy. But increasingly, every single time we've tried to go down this path with Facebook saying, well, hey, that was a nice benefit, or that was a nice consideration, or that seems like it should be good for the public. Sometimes it's a matter of hours later, we see something else, like, completely throw Facebook under again, where we need to be concerned about some other aspect of privacy violation, monetization of behavior, horrific algorithms manipulating behavior for the worst lowest common denominator profitability. And I'm just kind of tired. I'm kind of tired of trying to find some of the good in these announcements. And from the Meta announcement on, I want Facebook to have nothing to do. I want Zuckerberg completely unattached to the future and future generations of telecommunication and data-driven services on the internet. It's everything I can do to try and encourage more of my family to stop using any of their products or services. It's everything I can do to point to, like, hey, I know, like, they said this about Oculus, and, oh, you don't need your Facebook account anymore, but that's like a shell game. What are they going to do with Meta that's going to change how you use Facebook so they can be technically, legally correct and still operate in the scummiest fashion with your data and services? And I'm done. I want to be fair and even-handed and journalistic. My feels are too strong, and there is no trust. It's going to take an entire generation of Facebook product announcements and moves and a complete change of direction for this corporation for me to come back and say, hey, you know what? Like, that was pretty good. Now I'm feeling better. Maybe I can log into my Facebook account again and actually participate with people. Like, there is no near-term future that I can envision where I see myself saying something like that. And down to, like, my Instagram use being the barest minimum autopilot just for the photos that I share on Twitter. You know, like, that's about the extent that I can muster to contribute to any of Facebook's institutions. That's not the right word. You know what I'm saying. I'm driven to a high degree of inarticulateness whenever I talk about Facebook. And Gormlord, again, this is a terrible look. I don't even like them bogarting the word Meta. They have no business claiming they're going to be the metaverse or whatever it is. It's so much work just to get back to Second Life, right? Already, this is such an obnoxious tech buzz term. I'm already exhausted. Like, oh, you're gonna have a cartoon avatar and you can do all these magical things. And you're like, that's just a video game. It's just a wacky VR live chat. You're not giving me anything. You're not contributing. It still feels like you're just locking me into yet another time suck that will demonstrably make my life more difficult. And this is from JK33V3RS. What is this? J. Keevers? Is that what we're going for? Keevers? Oculus is not cheap. The gap between Oculus pricing and other pricing is the value of your data over the lifespan of the product. And I feel like that's another critical aspect. if you try to separate your Oculus from the more Facebooky, you know, data login and profile and data tracking, if you sever all of that, the Oculus gets way more expensive and you have to pay a yearly developer fee. So Oculus is real expensive if you value your own sort of privacy and data. That is an excellent point to be brought up on those kinds of situations. I was so frustrated by all the techies. Like, Oculus is such a great value. And yeah, to a point, you don't pay a lot of money to get one, but with what intention has Facebook ever risen to the occasion and done right by their customers? Like, they buy up other companies, they turn them into Facebook products and properties, and then we all go, oh, but it used to be so good before Facebook owned it. Oh. And you're like, it happens every single time. Oh, but if you don't want to buy a gaming PC, VR is so cheap. Great! I don't know what to tell you. From McCorkerin, Linus made a video about the Oculus and it was sponsored. That was a deal breaker for me. The Facebook account stuff. My mom recently lost her Facebook password and I could easily see that happening to me. I mean, even not just losing your Facebook password. This is where I do believe there needs to be some kind of FTC style examination of how a company like Facebook, like Amazon, like Google, even Apple can buy up these smaller developers and smaller organizations and staple them into their main product housing in a way that prevents competition. I mean, I feel like Facebook is the most public, but we need to have an overarching examination of these kinds of business practices across the entire tech industry. It doesn't matter if you call yourself Google or Alphabet, Facebook or Meta. There is something kind of insidious about this practice, and it needs to be untangled in a very legal fashion to see what the actual consumer harms are. We're getting the beginnings of those kinds of conversations, and because, you know, Facebook is an easy target to score some cheap political points right now. But again, this is going to take like two generations of examination before we eventually arrive at maybe some kind of AT&T style divestiture where we broke up the Bells, you know, all the baby Bells, the mom pa Bells, and that delivered a phenomenal amount of really positive competition for consumers. Right now, it's just too easy, and these tech companies have radically outpaced our legal system. our current elected officials are woefully incapable of digging through this kind of data and this type of consumer manipulation to arrive at better policy. It's going to take an entire generation of lawmakers aging their way out before we can get back in. Before we can really start fixing and addressing this kind of stuff. Get this out of the way here. I mean, and Streamy Boys, I mean, like, that works for me too. Facebook just needs to go the way of the dodo. I mean, that's fine. I miss MySpace. I miss having Tom as my friend. Get back into, like, what was that old, like, class... What was it? There was like a social media that was all about like finding old friends from high school. It wasn't classmates.com. I can't remember what it was. But I miss MySpace. Friendster. Ugh. Remember Friendster? So this is where we're going to take just a quick break. I need to drink some more water here. Maybe even stretch. Was it Classmates? Was it classmates.com? Was that the name of it? I can't, I mean, if you're telling me that that's what it was, I genuinely can't remember. From Fat Produce, I don't miss visiting a friend's MySpace page to have their random music blast my ears as soon as the page loads. But we learned so much about like basic HTML and like website design by looking at what not to do on MySpace. Billy Quizboy. Okay, so it is Classmates. Raymond is also saying there, and apparently it's still around. That seems incorrect. But again, like I was saying, like or that dead internet theory, right? That like the internet is basically rotting and shrinking in the background. That's on me because I have not gone to classmates.com in a really long time. Maybe since what? When did we? Is it like 2006? I can't even remember. Anyway, quick plug for the Reddit. We mentioned it earlier in the podcast, but there is a platform that I'm trying to help host and promote for sharing content that we feel deserves more attention. If you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, you will find a homegrown, true grassroots community. No shenanigans, no trying to mess with metrics or play with algorithms. And we have not only broken 2,000 members, but we've been growing steadily since breaking 2,000. We're almost properly to 2,100, and I have completely failed to do anything fun to celebrate that milestone. I feel like there's got to be some kind of Thanksgiving stream or community stream or something fun that we can do. Everyone keeps saying pizza party. I cannot buy that much pizza, but maybe that's going to be the energy. You know, like buy your own pizza and come celebrate 2,000 subscribers on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. The subreddit is not a me subreddit, all right? I need to load that first and foremost, and I have not done a plug in the podcast for a couple weeks. So we haven't been tracking all of the times that I've not taken the top spots. But I, like I said at the beginning of this podcast, I have been putting out a ridiculous amount of coverage on gadgets. So I need this to not be reflective of what you normally see if you sort this subreddit by top posts. It's normally not this weighted. Because I totally kicked ass on the subreddit this week. Number one. The top story of the last week, the Sony Xperia Pro I camera. Why is this so good? Number two, 2 weeks with the Pixel 6 Pro. Number three, my FTC report for reviews.org. And number four, Microsoft Surface Duo 2 by the benchmarks. Of the top five spots, I took the four top spots of the last week. So, like I said, I've been working really hard. So I'm going to take these wins. I feel really good about that. 2 weeks ago, I was like bottom 10, all right? Genuinely, I was not winning my own subreddit. This subreddit is not a place to come and just pat me on the back and tell me that I'm doing a good job. There is genuinely a phenomenally broad community of creators that are being shared. But rounding out the rest of the top 10 of the last week, Pixel 6 was obviously a popular topic, but we've got Adam Reviews Tech with 4,500 subscribers checking out the Pixel 6. We've got Team Vry with 2,100 subscribers looking at battery life and camera performance. Then we get Explaining Computers under 1,000 subscribers. He's going to get one more from me right now if YouTube will let me click on his channel. Linux Survival Guide number 2, Running Windows Applications. This is great. This is a channel that, I mean, I just watched this video. It was solid, you know, to the point, talking about how we can use different programs and different executables on different operating systems. Love it. Exactly the kind of content and conversation that I feel might help someone out sometime or someday. Billy Quizboy, I love Explaining Computers. I have just now discovered this channel because, who was it? ER1980 shared this channel on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I am happy to subscribe and support some really, really good homegrown video production. So we've got Pixel 6 versus iPhone 13 Pro camera comparison from Ike's Tech Talk. Ike, I think, just recently broke 1,000 subscribers. We've got Trent Tech, formerly Trent's Tech Rants, but talking about the tech community has become a toxic dumpster fire. I feel this is a conversation that more of us are getting tapped into and trying to express our issues with how we talk about consumer electronics. And then we can always count on ISA Does Tech, 86,000 subscribers, pink aesthetic desk setup, work from home station, ISA Does Tech. I don't know that there is a more fun content creator talking about style for gadgets than ISA. I learn a ton from her videos, and her videos fit none of the traditional review format from like the bigger YouTube tech channels. Like, if you want her to go and talk about frames per second in COD Mobile, you're going to the wrong creator. But if you want to go and have a really interesting conversation about style and design, and from someone who has smaller hands and different concerns and different needs than like a big tech dude bro, then you need to be following ISA. And this is what, again, week after week, plug after plug, every time we talk about it on the podcast, and when I'm there every day, like it's one of my tabs on my web browser, it's just constant that I'm checking in. The thing that really warms my heart about watching this experiment grow, we shouldn't have a consensus. There shouldn't be one point of view. There shouldn't be a winner or a loser ever. And I feel like the tech community has really dropped the ball on addressing all of the different needs and all of the different wants from a much broader or wider view of people who use fun, wacky gadgets. And I think it's way too easy to let the YouTube algorithm point you in a direction that's going to be more profitable for your channel, but then ignore an enormous collection of people all around the world. And it's so insulting and it's so regressive and reductive to go, well, I mean, those smaller channels, they can talk about the lesser than phones. I mean, if you got a little channel, you go and you make all the long-term follow-up videos you want. Increasingly, these larger YouTube channels, the only thing that they have to offer is first. They get early access, sometimes they get exclusive access, and then they shoot pretty B-roll. But you didn't glean a whole lot. You don't ever follow up on what those products have to offer. And they didn't really contribute to the conversation. So no, it's not, oh, those little channels, they can pick up all that extra slack. The wind is being sucked out of our sails by the YouTube algorithm front loading. You subscribe to any of these creators here, people under 1,000 subscribers, people under 5,000, under 100,000, click on one of their channels, subscribe, and then see what does YouTube try to follow that up with. You clicked on this channel with 800 subscribers and it's about tech, you must want to follow this massive tech creator with 10 million subscribers, right? Don't make our servers work at serving up all of the smaller creators. Just go to the big tentpole creator who only talks about a couple of things that's really easy for us to track and really easy for us to slap ads on. Because we're Google, and we know better than you. You have to go out of your way to support these creators and watch content outside of the funneling effect of the YouTube algorithm. So I tried to join this conversation. I'm trying to highlight this. I'm trying to support, and I'm trying to promote. And this is a place where if there's a creator that you follow, you think deserves more attention, share their stuff. Support it. Upvote other people's stuff so that this kind of feeds the platforms and the social media and the discoverability gets higher. This isn't a place about coming to like downvote things that you think are less popular. This is a place to try and spread the love and get people more attention when they're working their butts off. All of these people here are putting in insane hours for hundreds of views, sometimes thousands. Sometimes, you know, they go viral. But really, man, you want to talk about labor of love, it's all here. I mean, it's genuinely all here. I mean, I don't want people to go out of their way to downvote my stuff so that other people can be promoted on this subreddit. What I want is not to be the top of my own subreddit because you found someone else that you adored and you felt you needed to share them on every other social media platform you interact with. That's the game. I mean, I make a big joke out of it whenever I win my own subreddit, but that's the game. That's really what this is here for. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. again, I'm so encouraged by everything that I'm seeing on this. And again, it, like every week that I check back in on this, it encourages even more focus and participation and sharing. And I'm seeing so much more cool stuff. You know, I'm seeing people, you know, go from just, hey, I'll shoot, you know, dozens of videos on cases to taking their first steps into crafting an editorial. Do you know how exciting that is? There's this like format for how you grow and build a YouTube tech channel, and you talk about Apple and like you make a whole bunch of videos and Apple's always in the title, and oh, here's another Apple case review and here's an Apple case roundup and here's all of the best wristwatch straps for Apple watches. And then you watch someone take that step out and say, hey, you know what? I've been using these things and now I've got an opinion and that needs to be its own thought piece. And that sparks like an entirely different kind of conversation outside of the normal, like, safe box of YouTube tech content. And I'm seeing it happen more and more. And channels that are being built now just on, I mean, yeah, we can kind of roll our eyes at all the hot takes and all of the clickbaity thumbnails and stuff. But people putting thought and care and attention and criticisms into their products and putting them out there and trying to strike up those conversations and interactions is so much more satisfying to me than a never-ending, endless supply of copycat, shallow depth of field, cinematically shot, glowing rectangle reviews. Reviews that all kind of follow the same pattern format and are so predictable that now the PR agencies of major manufacturers can totally game them with their embargo strategies. Like, that's how predictable these big channels have become. You know kind of what the manufacturer's going to do to end run around that review style. So anyway, reddit.com/r/goingrectangles. I hope to see folks there. I hope to see more sharing. We need those upvotes. We need those comments and conversations. And don't be afraid to share things that aren't videos. Like, we're starting to see like a few more articles popping up, and we're starting to see a few more photos being shared, and we're starting to see a few more, just like, I had an opinion on this one gadget and I just wrote it up on the subreddit. So all of that additional participation, all of that additional content being sort of hosted here just makes me so much more excited for what kinds of conversations we're going to be having. I'm only in this to have fun, nerdy conversations and to be at the uncool kids lunch table in the larger tech cafeteria. And this is so up my alley now. I have made the thing that I want to consume. So anyway, I hope folks will check it out. And please subscribe and share and support, because I think you're gonna find your next favorite reviewers and editorialists and commentators from places like this. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. So, who wants to talk about some cool phones and stuff? Yeah? Hmm? Anyone? We're now into the last 40 minutes or so. I mean, I'll probably run long. Let's be fair. But I've got a Pixel 6 here. I had to send back the Xperia Pro I, so I'm going to have a video out on that for the Patreon, probably the end of this week.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Juan, thank you for the honor of having me on your podcast to kind of let everybody know that I do what's called Engineer Reacts. I react to smartphones, and you can find these reactions at www.youtube.com/C/Barry Johnson. I do about 1 to 2 video reactions per week, all on smartphone tech. Also, in addition to this, I'm actually going to start posting on Easy Computer Solutions channel as well, as he just has so much product that he tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, I need a little bit of help over there as well. So again, Juan, I appreciate it and hope you have a great rest of the podcast.
Cool phones. Me, pick me. I have a couple news stories here. You know what? Let me dig into. We've got some Pixel stories here that I think are very, very important. TK Bay hashtag cool phones FTW. Dave Burns, you should have tricked Sony and sent back your Xperia 1 Mark II. I mean, the thing is, so the whole thing with Sony PR, this, I don't want to get too into like, ooh, this is all the spicy behind the scenes details. But I have a really close working relationship with Sony PR. I have worked, I've done paid consulting and paid hosting for Google and for Sony. The video maker event that I did was set up through a relationship with Sony. And so, you know, that it's a full disclosure. Like, you can always take that for however you want to feel about me as an individual, as a reviewer, then also as a host for content also. Starting off the year, I got early access to the Xperia 1 Mark III in a very unfinished state. And same thing, Xperia Pro I, engineering sample, very unfinished state. And I never really did get back to the Xperia 1 Mark III like I feel I should have. It's such a good phone. It's such a unique phone. And I think it's very price competitive against the other kind of premium tier of gadgets. Just it's a Sony. It's going to be crazy different. But we're also seeing like how exciting Sony has been for selling more devices, pushing farther into a pro tier than any other manufacturer. And that this is, I think, the second full year of profitability from the Sony smartphone division. So when they reached out to me, they were like, hey, at some point we really would like to get you a retail unit that you can kind of do some other longer term coverage on. I was like, hey, that's great. Absolutely. I'm going to cancel my pre-order. I'm going to wait for them to send me a boxed unit. This is going to be awesome. The Sony PR rep flat out told me, Sony is shipping so many phones, any phone they make is satisfying like two or three tiers of back orders first. So whatever our techie concerns are, like, oh, it's too late to buy a phone now, you have to wait for the next generation of SoCs, and that's the smart money. If you want Sony features and you understand like they make in much smaller batches and they ship in limited regions and they ship limited numbers in those regions, they couldn't even give their PR team review units, retail box review units, to catch up on coverage. And I feel like that makes the phone review proof. It literally does not matter what I have to say about an Xperia 1 Mark III. Those phones cannot stay in stock in the quantities that Sony can manufacture them. They are evaporating before they can sort of fulfill. So I'm talking to them again. I'm hoping I can get an Xperia Pro I as a review unit. But if not, I'm going to have to really dig into the Some Gadget Guy budget for 2022 to make sure I can keep up with Sony and grab a Pro I to talk about. I mean, it's just crazy seeing how niche and how camera focused Sony has become and how successful that's made the smaller Xperia division. So, but we do have some Pixel news here. Let me get into these stories here real quick. From 9 to 5, Google's Pixel Foldable is going to be coming in 2022. Cameras will be a step down from the Pixel 6. When we talk about leaks and rumors, I appreciate, you know, let's be fair, this is probably going to be an expensive device. Any foldable gadget is likely going to be a significant price premium over a traditional slate. Anytime we've seen a phone with a hinge, genuinely, you should add $500 to $800 to the price of that phone. Hinges are expensive. So just because you can get a Duo 1 on a crazy fire sale, or the Fold 2 was cut half price after 6 months, that's not really the reflective price of all of the engineering and R&D and distribution that goes into making a folding phone. I'm not saying like, oh, you know, no poor people should ever be allowed to play with these things, but I think we've done a terrible job in the tech community of ascribing value to a gadget with moving parts. And the realistic aspect of this is if we don't really buy in to these experiments, they're going to go the way of LG. You know, we don't have that LG scrolling phone because we only considered LG to be worth it when you bought them in the bargain bin after the phone had completely failed and they needed to fire sale their remaining stock. That's going to happen to every other experiment if we can't encourage some consumer interest in a competitive marketplace where the R&D value of these things can be paid off and a company can profit. So the thing that I have a problem with these kinds of articles is the sort of doom and gloom. Like, oh no, a Pixel foldable, it's going to have the same cameras as a Pixel 5a? Oof, but who would buy that? Because these cameras are older and that means it's going to be garbage. So first, I mean, like, we've just got like the engineering concerns of putting on a GN1, right? I mean, I can't even like properly demonstrate just like how much thicker on video the phone is, let alone the phone plus camera bulge on the Pixel 6. And also, didn't we just go through the Fold 3 where we had a bunch of reviewers going, you know what? I'm glad that Samsung didn't go with the ultra cameras. I mean, it helps them save a little bit of money, and the cameras are good enough that, you know, you'll be fine. Especially like anyone who's using the Fold 3, they're probably not like super into photography and things. In fact, you know, the Fold 3 has this miserable internal selfie camera. Like, it's really bad. But it's good that Samsung did those things so that you could kind of fit those pieces together different. And it's like $100 cheaper than the Fold 2 was at launch. So that's good. So if you understand anything about cameras and optics and physics and software, you know, actually a Pixel 5a can still give the Pixel 6 a run for its money in a lot of processing situations because we haven't updated all of those algorithms for the Pixel 6. That newer camera sensor still needs a lot of polish. Not to say that it's you don't get any benefit. It's to say your practical comparisons between a Pixel 5 camera and a Pixel 6 camera need to be very specific right now. And I feel like that's also fair for a Samsung. You can spend $1,800 on a Fold 3, or you can spend a lot less on an Ultra. And if what you care about is the camera, then I think you'll be happier with an S21 Ultra, right? Like, this is pretty easy. So when we talk about a potential Pixel foldable, the Pixel 5a cameras are still remarkably solid. Like, they're great shooters. Not like, oh, they're okay. We didn't somehow magically change camera physics that now the cameras are garbage. You know, the cameras that have been working successfully since the Galaxy S7 and have been refined with better and better processing algorithms to the point of the Pixel 5a are still phenomenal shooters. Like, they're still great shooters. So I'm not too concerned. What's going to be critical is, will Google be able to undercut a Fold in the same way that they undercut the FE? And I don't want this to be a race to the bottom price. The only way that you can ever consider something else a value is if, you know, it has all of the same features and bells and whistles. It's built exactly the same way and it's like half the price. Because that kind of tech reviewer nonsense just needs to be slapped. Like, just, you know, like, line them up Three Stooges style and just running as fast as you can. Just go tack, 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 tack. Because we can't let Samsung and Apple define what's worth it to spend money on. Everything needs to be an open and more competitive marketplace. So I'm not the biggest fan of folding plastic screens. I don't like plastic on my thumbs, especially when I'm gaming. The Fold makes me wiggy just for the way that screen feels and kind of flexes as you use it. I don't like it. But I'm really anxious to see what Google can do with the foldable. And especially if we're talking Tensor, some refinement, Android 12L is on the horizon. I'm curious. They've piqued my curiosity. But the other critical story that we need to bring in, and this is going to take us now more into just the fun stuff on Pixel 6, I have to throw an incredible thumbs up. This is an amazing video. If you haven't watched it, I'm going to be kind of spoiling the conclusion, but that's not really the point. The whole journey of how this video rolls is just amazing. Hugh Jeffries, his channel has been exploding. I mean, he's at 727,000 subscribers, and I feel the quality of his content, he totally deserves an extra zero at the end of his subscriber count. The consistency and application of his review style and teardown style is fantastic. I understand the fun gadget destruction porn videos where we're really trying to break phones and we're hacking at them with picks and we're holding lighters to the screen. I get it. It's visually entertaining. But Hugh Jeffries really needs 10 times more viewership for holding to a methodology that is way more in line with iFixit than Will It Blend. There is an entertainment value to seeing how many phones you can line up and shoot a high caliber bullet through them. There is an entertainment value to doing unscientific drop tests just to watch someone smash and eventually break an expensive gadget. There is something so much more intellectually satisfying about watching a knowledgeable individual, like in a near clean room style environment, properly break down a gadget to see what's inside of it. And then do those comparative tests that help us understand better why things like right to repair are so incredibly important to the future of our digital and the future of our economy, our consumer electronics. The Pixel 6 video from Hugh Jeffries is flipping fantastic. So he gets two Pixel 6 Pros, takes them fully apart. We get to see how impressively repairable these phones are. I think the big problem is maybe the USB-C port. But he gets down into some of the FUD that we saw on the Pixel 6 Pro launch, where a handful of articles came out that, oh no, Google is going to be serializing parts, and that's bad. We saw Samsung start copying Apple. It makes repairability so much more difficult. It pushes third-party repair organizations out of a competitive landscape. It makes gadgets more disposable, which just contributes to more e-waste. What is Google doing? Oh no, oh no, oh no. So he swaps the camera modules between these two phones, and the cameras are still fully functional. So if those parts are being serialized, Google is not preventing you from using those products because the serial numbers don't match. That is very, very important. If you swap the camera modules on an iPhone, see, this is what's so frustrating. You take two iPhones, and you know that those are Apple certified parts because they're literally in the iPhone. But if you start swapping those components between the two phones, the software serial numbers don't match. It breaks the functionality of those products, and that harms the consumer, right? Say the consumer needs to replace a screen. They don't have access to an Apple store. They can't send it off to wait for a really long repair. They need this fixed right away. They will not have an option to do that because if you swap the screen on an iPhone, it might break a whole bunch of security or battery charging, like things that you wouldn't think about breaking just because you replace the screen. So Google might be serializing the camera modules, but it doesn't seem to impact performance if you swap the camera module out. So this is an important concern. Like, I'm not just trying to harp on this because, like, well, who would ever really need to do this? If you pick up a Pixel 6 Pro and you see this huge lump of glass that sticks out the back of this camera visor, I do believe this is going to be a potentially high point of failure. On a slippery glass curved edge phone, this is a large target to potentially damage. So having another option to replace parts of your camera module or camera assembly are going to be critical if you want this to be repairable. That that's this literally, it's big. So it's kind of a big deal. The other part that I thought was just brilliant, the way he tested it, was the fingerprint sensor. Replacing a security component on a phone that is marketed so heavily for having a higher tier of device security is a huge deal. So if you smash the front screen and you need to replace the screen assembly and the fingerprint assembly, when you put the phone back together, the fingerprint sensor doesn't work. You try to scan your thumbprint and it's going to wig out and say, hey, there's something wrong. This isn't the right security module that we had in place when this phone was constructed. And that's the same thing that happens on like an iPhone. Like if you had Touch ID, if you try to replace the power, the home button on an older iPhone, the phone would lock up and sometimes just brick. And like the consumer was just screwed. You know, like your phone was just now a paperweight. You violated the security and tried to compromise it, shut it down. And there were times throughout the life cycle of iPhones, like it just wasn't repairable. You would have to like get a refurb from Apple instead. That was your repair. They would just exchange it. Google has made the software calibration tools accessible. So you get this phone, you smash the screen, you replace the screen and the fingerprint sensor. You'll have to probably hard reset the phone, but you can go, it's public. Like you can just, you right now watching this or listening to this, you can just go get this calibration software. It runs in a Chrome browser. You don't even have to do anything fancy for this verification process to finish. And then it resets your phone. It properly calibrates the fingerprint sensor and you're back and running again. And Hugh showed like, I swapped the components. I had to verify the phone. I put them all back together again. I put the components back. I had to re-verify those components and then everything was copacetic. That is such a big deal. Like Google deserves all the credit. Like we're always being so sensitive to like, well, I mean, doesn't Samsung deserve this for doing that? And you're like, cool, yeah, I guess they're the market leader. They've done the bare minimum. Congratulations. That is the direction we need all manufacturers to go. There is no excuse for any company that is now trying to copy Apple's business model. It's bad for consumers. It's bad for businesses. It's bad for the environment. It is the worst possible way to extract more monies out of your consumer base. And also any company that's claiming to, you know, be concerned about waste and e-waste in the environment, but they have business practices that make it more difficult to repair their gadgets. That is not okay. I don't care, you know, how much you save on shipping iPhones by taking the charger out of the box. Everything that that Apple has demonstrated has been to gouge consumers and businesses and governments, because it's our state and local governments that have to figure out what to do with e-waste and have to improve recycling programs. And Apple gets to profit off of that because they're not a part of that last step of, but what to do with all this? Even when Apple breaks down these products and ends up with materials that need to be disposed of, Apple isn't making their own landfills. Apple isn't making their, I mean, they're getting better at taking these things apart. That doesn't mean that they've finished the entire last step of the environmental issue at the same time that they're making their products harder to repair. So this, to me, Hugh Jeffries is doing such an amazing job of fulfilling this part of the conversation. Now, increasingly, I go to Hugh and iFixit. Those are the outlets that I respect the most, that I follow the most consistently, for joining this conversation. Oh, and of course, Luis Rossman, just for the right to repair conversation. But like when it comes to actually breaking the gadgets down, Hugh and iFixit. I'm so over gadget destruction porn. I'm so over hot takes that are inconsistent. Like it was such a deal breaker that the LG G8 battery is they use adhesive to stick the battery into the frame. No one should ever buy an LG because of this battery adhesive. Oh wait, Samsung did the same thing the next year? Well, I mean, that's fine. It's fine that Samsung, I mean, if you use some solvents, you can get around the battery adhesive. But last year I said LG was completely unbuyable. But this year it's fine. I mean, it's a bummer. I wish they didn't do it. But I mean, you should still buy Samsungs, obviously. Inconsistency sucks because it's manipulated by profitability and telling people the nice things about their gadgets. Smaller community of LG fans, slap them around, they don't matter. Larger community of Samsung fans, well, I mean, there are some concerns, but we're always going to say, you bought the right gadget, Samsung owner. Now keep watching my videos, because that makes me more money. I've never seen Hugh compromise on this style of conversation. I've never seen Hugh come to one conclusion for one phone that gets a ton more traffic and then come to a different or manipulated conclusion on a different phone that gets way less traffic. Again, he's got 727,000 subscribers. This video has only pulled 110,000 views. I guarantee you, any video that he's made with Apple or iPhone in the title probably add an extra zero to that view count. I guarantee you any video that he's put together talking about Samsung copying Apple's shenanigans with right to repair has easily doubled this view count. We want to support good information being distributed. This video needs to be shared, needs to be celebrated, needs to be posted all over Reddit, needs to be thumbs up and upvoted and commented on. This is what we need. If we're going to keep someone like Hugh this consistent, the videos he puts out on less search popular phones need to be pushed even more aggressively than the videos he puts out on Sam Apple. I adore this. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, someone just mentioned Apple's just greenwashing. It's such AstroTurf commentary. It's like so not real. But I don't want to talk about Apple. I want to talk about Pixel 6, because Pixel 6 has been a surprisingly fun phone to use. McCorkerin 3. I've been guilty of this a little bit. On an unrelated note, I hate when reviewers say, "Is it the best camera sensor screen in the world? No. But is it the worst? No." Well, thanks. So now I know it's in that range. It's in the range of bestest to worstest. I genuinely believe all products are on some kind of spectrum. There's a very good reason why almost all of my gadget reviews ultimately sound so positive. It's not I'm going to have the tough, hard, critical takes for gadgets. It's the quality of the gadget, in my opinion, needs to be balanced on two major criteria. What were the manufacturer's claims, and who is the target demographic for this gadget? Because the Pixel 6 is making some interesting claims, and there are some really frustrating things that we need to push back on Pixel 6. But I feel Google is not trying to make some kind of outlandish claim on the Pixel 6. There are not, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on advertising the Pixel 6 as a cinema-grade Hollywood replacement content creation platform. That's not what Pixel 6 is being marketed as. There are no annoying, cloying, feel-good advertisements about the Pixel 6, about it achieving the impossible, right? You know, the do-what-you-can't, everyday epics. I don't feel we should judge Pixel 6 by the same kind of criteria that we judge Samsung and Apple, because Samsung and Apple make outrageously unrealistic claims about their gadgets. They are setting that bar to a higher tier, and I don't think Google's doing the same thing. It bothers me that the Pixel 6 Pro is called a Pro, because boy howdy, this is not a pro phone, especially if you've ever used an Xperia or if you've played with features like DeX. DeX to me is a professional grade piece of software that needs way more attention. Same thing, Screen Plus on an LG, Ready 4 on a Motorola. If your profession is documents and spreadsheets and telecommunications infrastructure and VPNing and all those things, boy howdy, the Pixel 6 is not a pro. So I wish that this were a Pixel 6 Plus or a Pixel 6 XL or maybe even a Pixel 6 Ultra. I said that in my video. I'm repeating myself here. But we need to push back on some of that idea too. Really, the things that kind of bother me the most about Pixel 6 are some of the inconsistencies in messaging. I need Google to kind of hold my hand just a little bit more on what are some of the practical benefits of Tensor. They made their own SoC and they're focusing heavy on machine learning and AI, and their own apps are going to demonstrate some of that stuff really, really well. Speech to text transcription, voice commands, better assistant integration. I get that. I have a hard time verifying the success or failure of Tensor until we have some other method of kind of tracking the progress of third-party apps also getting to benefit from this hardware. That to me is the competitive thorn in my side, because if it's traditional compute stuff, I can time video rendering, I can time batch photo processing, I can time file compression, video stabilization, all these other aspects of performance, and I can come to some conclusion saying, hey, this phone performs these tasks better than these other phones. So that is the hardest part I have with the Pixel 6 experiment, is I'm used to being able to verifying claims. These are claims that I can't test. It's kind of like Bluetooth audio quality, right? I can listen and do a lot of critical listening to Bluetooth headphones, but I can't measure Bluetooth headphones with the same ease and accessibility as I can a headphone jack on another product, right? At some point, I just got to go, hey, I think this sounds better, and I'm not going to spend $10,000 on some fancy binaural measurement rig, because I don't really feel like it's $10,000 worth of conversation. And other people can do that, and you can go and look at frequency response graphs. I can't bring myself to care about Bluetooth earbuds to that same degree, nor will that investment ever pay itself off on a channel like mine. So, Pixel 6 so far has had some of those frustrating moments. Like for me, again, the advertising on the cameras. These are 12 megapixel cameras. We've gotten ourselves stuck because we talk about the megapixels, right? It's a 48 megapixel. It's a 50 megapixel, 108 megapixel. Next year, Samsung's going to put out a 200 megapixel camera. Whoa, megapixels. So reviewers have gotten so lazy, we're not doing a very good job of discussing the pros and cons of pixel binning, larger camera sensors, comparative analysis. We just sort of go, oh, well, iPhones have larger camera sensors and Galaxy Ultras have larger camera sensors. I guess that's the same. And then we use these ridiculous marketing numbers like the megapixels to compare what's a newer or better technology, but that really isn't the primary use. So I'm not bothered by the photo output. All of the aspects of a Pixel 6 that depend on a larger camera sensor are demonstrated here. You do get better low light performance. The RAW files are kind of tricky to talk about because they're kind of a compressed RAW, like an MRAW. You get a shallower depth of field. You know, those aspects of using a larger sensor are represented well here. But it's such a consumer hurdle to say this is a 1 over 1.3 inch camera sensor. That doesn't mean anything to consumers because we haven't really educated them. So instead, they say it's a 50 megapixel sensor. That's lazy, but it's technically true. And it kind of gets the point across that this is using a newer camera sensor than the sensor that's on the Pixel 5a, because other reviewers have dropped the ball on properly educating people on what these things mean. The function of this camera is to deliver a 12 megapixel JPEG. And so you listen to these reviewers and they're like, oh, but it's really only a 12 megapixel camera. And they're going to talk about that as if that somehow makes it the same as a Pixel 5a. But that's obviously not the case. So you can kind of backpedal and like, oh yeah, but I mean, like, I guess it's a little bit better for low light or something. And you're like, why can't you just demonstrate what the practical differences are? If you claim to care about this for average consumers, it's pretty easy to just show your work. Take two reasonably similar photos, compare and contrast, and don't do the gimmick of like, well, I put them on a rig so they're side by side, because that doesn't really, you don't arrive at the same composition. You have to compose the shots with effort at similar times of day to arrive at the same frame so that then you can compare the similar photos. But I've gone off on a tangent there. Those are the kind of things that have been bugging me about Pixel 6. The battery life has been solid. The fingerprint sensor is interesting. How do I want to put this? It's lower mid pack. So again, who was it that said, you know, like it's in the range of not the bestest, but not the worstest, right? You know, so the spectrum of all fingerprint sensors that I've used, top of the pack right now for me, anything that has a dedicated piece of hardware and is not in the display is immediately a higher tier of consideration. Xiaomi's power button fingerprint sensor, the Sony power button, the Duo 2 power button, and the rear casing fingerprint sensors, like on the Pixel 5a. Those are the bestest. Put the fingerprint sensor somewhere where you have a dedicated piece of hardware to accomplish the fastest and most accurate scan. That's on our tier at the bestest. On our tier of the worst assists are all in display fingerprint sensors. We have made fingerprint sensors better. They have gotten better. They are nowhere near the same league or tier as a dedicated hardware fingerprint sensor. Just has never happened. And they can be really stymied by the use of screen protectors, the fact that you're constantly swiping and typing and smudging your screen in the moment that you need to use an in-display fingerprint sensor. Is your phone screen clean? Because if it's not, that's going to impact performance, and impact performance to a higher degree than having a dedicated fingerprint sensor. Like, the smudges that I can get on the back of a Pixel 5a don't contribute as much to degrading fingerprint sensor performance, but I'll tell you, you know, my phone screens are never clean because I'm using my phone. That's our window. So of the in-display fingerprint sensors, the biggest problem I have with the Pixel 6 is it's kind of got a two-stage process, and that slows you down just a bit. So I'm trying to think of, like, what's a better, like, a faster fingerprint sensor, like you might find. Let me see. I can kind of do this in real time. Like, I've got my OnePlus 9 here, and it just finished charging. And here I am. I'm wiping my OnePlus 9 on my shirt because I have the original installed screen protector, and it's pretty scuffed up and it's kind of dirty. So if I hold, okay. So when I hit the fingerprint sensor on a OnePlus 9, there's this one little pulse. I have to kind of wake the phone up in some way first. So either it's a pickup action or it's a double tap on the screen. But once I engage the fingerprint sensor, there's this one little pop and the screen just turns on. The wake up process on a Pixel, you feel like you've got two actions. So it's like you've got to like wake it up first, and then there's a second pulse that gets you into the phone and unlocks the phone. And I think that's kind of what's slowing down a lot of people. You go to that first pop or that first feel, and if you go to move off of that, you won't finish the verification on that fingerprint sensor. But ultimately, when you compare this kind of against some of the other solutions, it's definitely a slower and a stickier. It's a more deliberate action than a OnePlus or a Samsung. I'm hoping that this will be more manageable. I've got a plastic. Well, let me take a drink of water here real quick. I have a plastic, a TPU screen protector on the Pixel 6 just because I needed something. And I retrained my fingerprint. And again, it's very consistent, but there's a two pulse action. So it feels slower than any other phone. If you remember, there are some terrible in-display fingerprint sensors out there. Like the LGs, the Velvet, and to some degree, the Wing. I don't know what they did, but the 765 powered phones were always noticeably laggier than like the V60. The V60 wasn't the fastest, and in fact, I'd probably put the Pixel 6 above the V60 for both speed and consistency. Like I have to rescan my thumb fewer times per unlock on the Pixel 6 than I do on my V60. But you pick up a Velvet and you go to scan it, and you've got to hold your thumb there. Like, that thing is going to take its time. Another slower in-display would be the one on the TCLs. It's not bad, but it's slow. It's slower than what we've got here. So again, you know, I can't just go out and say, this is terrible. It needs to be better. It needs to be faster performance. It's actually pretty good. But what are we comparing it against? If you're comparing a Pixel 6 in-display fingerprint sensor against the beautiful power button sensor on a Xiaomi Mi 11, they're barely comparable. It's like comparing Little League T-ball versus, you know, like Major League Baseball. They're the same sport, but one of these teams is going to be a lot more proficient than the other. But if we're comparing it against the wide spectrum of quality of other in-display fingerprint sensors, then I think we're fine. It's not the best, but it's certainly not the worst, and it's somewhere in the middle there, maybe just lower mid-pack, based on the feel of how you start the verification process. Like, that's so difficult. It took so many words to describe, but people want the, no, I mean, I heard it was terrible. Well, I think you heard wrong. But if you really want to know what this feels like, you either got to try it and like live with it for a bit, or you've got to just trust that what I'm telling you is kind of a lived-in experience that's been informed by more than just a week's worth of use. And that's what's so tough. Like, it's so hard to get that point across. Gormlord, true. I mean, same. I'm right there with you. Power button sensors are the best, and nothing can change my mind. From Awesome Possum, I'm looking for the "we are not the same" meme now applied to fingerprint sensors. That's hilarious. Hold on, there are a couple other comments that I do want to kind of get back to. From Sveticus, going from the S21U's under-display fingerprint sensor to the Fold 3's dedicated sensor on the side, I can honestly say I missed the traditional sensor. 21U never read my fingerprint after a glass screen protector. I had to switch to using the pin. I know that feel a lot, especially like face unlock had issues when we all started wearing masks and fingerprints. Like, I understand why they walked back from it. The Pixel 4 has a great face unlock system. I don't like face unlock. I want a phone that is already verifying and is already becoming active before I hold it up to my face. I'm taking it out of my pocket, and a Xiaomi Mi 11 is awake and ready for me to use it before it's fully out of my pocket. That is good design. The Pixel 6 is a bit pokier. I mean, like, it's a bit more deliberate. I'm holding the bottom of this phone and I'm getting it to verify, but it's generally ready for me when I kind of need it. Face unlock, it's such a grandmotherly verification process for me. I have to pull it out of my pocket. If I'm out and about, I need to take off my mask, even with all these different, like, well, you can pair it with your Apple Watch to do this, to do that. And you're like, nah, we can't complain about people digging through settings on unpopular phones and then expect everyone to be super sleuth detectives to figure out how to make their iPhones work. But same thing with the Pixel 4. It has genuinely become so much less fun to use out in public because the real world, like, I pull it out and it's waking up and I see the lock screen and then I, like, it's like that extra beat. I don't even know if my Pixel 4 is on right now. Let's see. The battery might be dead on it. Oh, it just failed. It just failed to unlock. I just pointed it at my face and I'm not wearing a mask and it just went, oh, I don't know, who are you? You know, when I just generically hold my Mi 11, my thumb is automatically in the best place to unlock it. I actually have a problem with the Mi 11 unlocking too easily. So hold on, let's wake it up again. God, let me put in my PIN. I'm gonna turn it off. And now it went. I had to lift it to wake it. And then it didn't do anything, and then I had to angle it, and then it unlocked. The Pixel 4 is such a good example of, like, the speed and the verification and, like, the power of a face unlock. It is demonstrably slower than any dedicated fingerprints solution. It drives me crazy. It is not better. It doesn't make my daily use or interaction with these products better. Sorry, I have digressed again. from Tiger Kim, how do you feel about the 30 watt charging being limited to 22 watts? Again, this kind of goes back to the same thing that we were talking. You know what? If you go out there and you say, hey, we've got a slower charging as a benefit of battery longevity, you can get ahead of these conversations so much more gracefully. And I feel like this is yet another one of those. It's technically true because it's designed around a certain thermal envelope with a certain wattage of charger. But the reality is you didn't put that charger in the box. So someone, like, I plug my phones in. Mostly I'm on OnePlus chargers right now because the OnePlus chargers are rad fast chargers for most gadgets. And man, the Pixel 6 is slow. But, you know, I don't have this issue with a Sony, which is even slower to charge. Because Sony goes out of their way to talk about power management and battery health. That is a major selling point of a Sony, HS power control and battery conditioning and battery health and making your phone last longer. You feel good charging your phone slower because that is a part of the conversation of a Pixel. And I kind of wish Google had just gone in for the same kind of conversation on the Pixel 6 Pro. Like, we understand this is one potential perk, fast charging your phone. We have concerns with our own SoC and battery and what we feel consumers care about, that what we're going to do is more intelligently learn your charging style and minimize those spikes of heat and battery degradation. And I think you'd have a bunch of people out there going, like, you know what? That's a cool idea. It's different, and it won't be for everybody because some people want to charge their phone as fast, as crazy fast as possible, but I can dig that. Instead, we've got this poorly marketed metric. It's a spec, 30 watt, that now the phone can't live up to, so it's a fail. And this, to me, is the psychology of putting out phones and putting out gadgets and consumer electronics that I feel a number of manufacturers keep missing. You're allowed to do this if you're Apple. You're allowed to do this if you're Samsung. No one else is allowed. And you get to the end of like a Sony video, and the reviewers have to just basically admit they didn't really use the phone, and that's why they're recommending you buy a Samsung. Look at every single one of those, like, hack Sony reviews where, well, I guess the camera features could appeal to professionals. Did you use them? Why can't you show me? Well, I mean, I guess there are some gamers out there who might care about something like HS power control. Did you try it? Did you measure it? Why can't you show me? But again, if you have all of these nice things to say about a Sony and you can get to the end of the video and say, hey, you know what? there are some people out there that will probably like this better than a Samsung. You've trained your Samsung owning audience to get almost violent about the barest, like lowest level consideration that another product could be just as good. So instead, you've got to sort of feign ignorance. You know, like, I don't know what Sony's sales strategy is. You can't tell because they're putting out quarterly financials and their financials are really strong right now. But I mean, I guess if they want to just appeal to a niche, they called their phone Pro for a reason. You know, like every single time you try and break it down, like they have to purposely misinterpret or forget how to review a gadget when it comes to something like a Sony. I promised someone a conversation about the SoC and Tensor, and I can't remember who asked. I will never be able to find that comment. I am so sorry.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Just real quick, from the Streaming Boys, there's no reason any device can't be 30-watt charging at this point, though. Tired of Apple and Samsung calling 20-watt fast charging. Xiaomi and OnePlus are killing the game with charging speeds. 30-watt should be the minimum that gadgets are charging in 2021. I mean, I think the hard thing to pin down is a conversation about battery capacity, different methods of fast charging, different protocols for fast charging, and how those are compatible against different products. So yes, Xiaomi and OnePlus, they are. Those are some of the fastest charging devices, and they have proprietary standards for how they accomplish the fastest tier of charging. And with split battery cells, unfortunately, what we'll have to do is kind of look for another 2 years of data to see over the life cycles of these phones what kind of impact that has on battery life as consumers are trying to hold on to their phones for longer periods of time. That was a lot of talking. So I don't feel that there's a substantive consumer benefit to putting one specific label on this is fast charging. I think we need to do a better job of educating consumers. Now that chargers are no longer in the box, these are universal charging protocols like USB power delivery, and these are proprietary charging protocols like warp charging, so that they understand what power draw and what battery drain they're putting on their products. That's the consumer benefit for me. I'm a little less concerned on a product that genuinely can go almost 2 days of my use, that it charges a little slower, but I need Google to get ahead of that conversation and actually extol what are the compatibilities, what chargers will deliver this faster charging speed at 30 watts, and what chargers are going to trickle charge, because they didn't put the charger in the box. So now it's on them to educate their potential consumers. That's what I'm frustrated about. I don't care that much that one label hits a threshold, and over that, now we can call it fast charging. What I need is better explicit compatibility so that people don't wear out their product faster over time, or that they have a better understanding of what's going to charge their device cooler over time. Those compatibilities to me are so much more important than just one spec or rating. Apple Fast Charging runs iPhones really hot. They're not utilizing any of the same types of power management, amp wattage playing that, you know, a Xiaomi might. It's just literally a more brute forced juice the battery up faster. And that's bad for an iPhone because those batteries wear out. You know, like Apple, for as much as the battery life has improved on the iPhone 13, the iPhone 12 is not a good battery life option. And the 5Gs really tanked that Apple battery life. So anyway, I do want to wrap this up talking about SoC and performance. Again, I'm so sorry, I've forgotten who asked the question, but Tensor is an interesting beast. I'm kind of dislocating my eyeballs for all the people that are just so proud of themselves for saying things like, well, it's basically just a Samsung Exynos. Like, you have to really be proud of your ignorance. And just, you're so desperate to put your ignorance on full display to drop those kinds of comments on other videos. Tensor is a first generation focus on a different style of machine learning and AI cores. Google is wanting to step away from the way that Qualcomm is putting in neural core technology on Snapdragon processors. That has created a really interesting combination of traditional computer hardware. The CPU cores are fundamentally different. So just the fact that Samsung is fabbing this SoC, and these cores are similar in structure to the kinds of cores that Samsung has fabbed before, this an entire system on chip, SoC, is not defined by the architecture, structure, and fabrication of just the CPU cores. So just because the CPU cores are kind of similar to Exynos CPU cores completely misses the point on the combinations and all of the other supporting hardware that goes into making a system on a chip. And the performance actually does kind of speak to that. When you try to compare it in traditional compute tasks, it does some interesting things well. It performs poorer in some other ways, and it definitely loses the race to chipsets that depend on the absolute fastest single core performance from the biggest processing blocks on an SoC. If you want to sprint and you want a foot race, you need an 888, hands down. I think the Pixel 6 has actually been a surprisingly consistent performer, though. Where the Pixel 6 doesn't win a lot of races, it has performed surprisingly well in a lot of kind of consistency ways. Less thermal throttling, even though it arrives at a slower overall batch processing time on things like photo editing. It is definitely not speedy for video rendering, and there are still some compatibility issues with other apps. Like, I still can't get PowerDirector to spit out a 4K video. It's new. It's a new SoC. It's new software. We only just got Geekbench to fix their GPU benchmark, so we could even just look at what some numbers might be on this GPU benchmark. That was hilarious. A bunch of like iPhone tryhards, like, oh, my iPhone 11 has a higher metal score than your Vulcan score, and that makes me a better person. And, like, you really don't know what you're talking about, but you're really interested in showing everyone that you don't know what you're talking about. So when we get to things like thermals, it's very difficult to express to a potential consumer that I don't find it as problematic that a Pixel 6 is going to run noticeably warmer than their Pixel 4 might have performed. I don't find it too troubling that in daily operation and in some of the basics, a phone with big X1 cores that falls back on medium-sized A76 cores and has a really thirsty GPU is going to put out more heat. And especially when people are coming at this from like a 2 or a 3 year old phone, our phones didn't used to heat up like this. I feel what's germane to that conversation is comparing that kind of thermal load and that kind of inconsistency in performance, some of the thermal throttling against other similarly equipped current generation phones. The 888 is definitely faster and it definitely scores higher in a number of CPU bound tasks. I find the performance to be a lot more inconsistent, where you'll get a spike of faster performance, but it's harder to count on consistent performance over the course of a longer task. That really manifests on the GPU side. You know, if I pick up my Xiaomi Mi 11, which I've been praising quite a bit over the course of this podcast, if I play a game that kind of unlocks the frame rate, it's sort of a coin flip whether or not the game is going to play well on the Mi 11. The Mi 11 isn't putting any kind of limiter or block. It kind of lets the app dictate how much power it's going to draw. And on a game like Undead Horde, the frame rate will crater bad. The game is unplayable on a Xiaomi Mi 11. The game is respectively performative. We see respectable performance like in the high 40s, low 50s, and it just stays there on a Pixel 6. It is so much more reliable. And this is a conversation that we started off on the Galaxy S21. The Galaxy S21 ships CPU limited out of the box because Samsung is already aware of some of the performance issues of this chip. And we got to really drive this idea home, if you're rocking something Snapdragon 845, you know, a 3-year-old premium tier phone is the compute power level that so much of our software is written for. So if you get a Galaxy S21 and you take it out of the box, the performance feel of that phone is gonna feel almost identical to a Galaxy S10. That's how managed the CPU performance is on an S21. You have to go out of your way to kick on all of the horsepower of this amazing, do what you can't everyday epic, most powerful processor that Samsung has ever put into a phone, because that's not what Samsung is giving you out of the box. So an S21 out of the box is often a poorer performer than a Pixel 6 Pro. That's just the consumer reality. But consumers don't get to play with every single phone side by side. So often they have to trade in a phone to get a deal on their new phone. And then they pick up their new phone and you're like, oh, you know what? This phone feels like it's running a lot warmer than my old phone did, but I can't do any kind of comparison testing on this because I had to do a trade-in. The psychology on that is funky. I mean, it really is. But we're rapidly running into this diminishing returns where we keep having to advertise bigger and bigger bar graphs. This phone is going to be 60% more powerful than the competition. It's 80% more powerful than the phone it replaces. The phone that's in your pocket now is now garbage, obviously. But like, if you're still on a Snapdragon 845, you're still on laptop grade mobile compute hardware. Like, genuinely. Heavy lifting, 4K video rendering, document engine, search, social media, like an 845 is to me is the tier. And everything above that is gravy. But when we really max out all of that additional horsepower and compute power, we've got to deal with the trade-offs of thermal throttling until we can kind of optimize this stuff better. And that's the promise. I don't know that Google can fully realize that promise, but I think they've got a pretty good handle on how much more performance they've eked out of the Pixel 4. The Snapdragon 855 on the Pixel 4 is one of the poorest benchmarking versions of an 855 phone, but it's gotten significantly and noticeably faster in real life tasks than any of my other 855 phones. I've got a Pixel 4 and a Galaxy S10e sitting right in front of me right now. This phone has gotten slower for all of my real world tests
this phone has gotten faster for all of my real world tests. And in things like video rendering, this phone was already significantly faster than this phone. So that's why we've got to stray from some of this casual or anecdotal, but this phone's getting so warm. My phone never gets warm. My phone never overheats. My phone never lags. BS. I'm sorry. All phones, I mean, unless you do nothing on your phone, but just occasionally turn on the screen and then turn it back off again, all phones run warm. All processors can be taxed. All UIs will stutter. All computers will skip or lag. All software has to go through a sort of a process of being better optimized. That it's just the reality of what a computer is in the 21st century. So this is an incredibly long and rambling way to kind of talk about this stuff. But I find comparably, the Pixel 6 Pro has not demonstrated anything to me that would read as concerning in terms of performance, but it desperately needs the follow-up attention and polish that all products should receive. You get a OnePlus 9 on embargo week, it's kind of a mess. You get a OnePlus 9 2 months after launch, it is a radically different experience. You get a Samsung with the newest version of a One UI update, it's gonna be rough. Every single major One UI update has been kinda rough. If you get a Samsung a couple months after they've put out some updates, it is a much better experience. Newest version of iOS, always a mess. There's the reason why we have this feeling, you know, this kind of anecdotal feeling that software updates slow down our phones. That's largely Apple's fault, because successive iOS updates have done a really good job of throttling older phones because of battery degradation. That's not a feeling that people are just making up. That's literally true of how Apple crafts their ecosystem. To date, I find the company that has done the best job of getting more performance out of their products and adding new features across their entire product line while giving us some of the best software support for older and mid-range phones has been Google. So, it's very clever to say, well, we shouldn't ever buy a phone on what it might be able to do in the future, but we don't mean that for Samsung and we don't mean that for Apple. I feel Google is safe to add to that list. I would be more concerned with a Sony. I would be a lot more concerned with a Motorola. Microsoft has shown us that they're very patient with the software on phones like the Duo. I don't have enough data to speak on for Vivo or for Xiaomi devices, what their updates feel like over a longer period of time. But I think OnePlus has been pretty consistent. They used to be one of the best and now they're kind of average, but they've still been very consistent getting new software out to my OnePlus 9s. I feel like Google deserves the consideration of having demonstrated since the age of the Nexus that they can update and improve the quality of their software over time. It's never finished. It's never perfect. There are always sticky bits that need to be addressed, but this is true of all phones. And this is why, to me, this like week one reviewer outrage that like a new operating system with a new UI on a new SoC on a new phone with a new camera isn't 100% perfect. Because no gadget is. I have a Galaxy S10e sitting in front of me, and I adore this little Mighty Mouse of a Samsung. It's the last Samsung I really have enjoyed using for its features and its size and what it can do. There are still One UI bugs on my S10e. Why hasn't Samsung perfectly polished this phone? What the heck? I thought Samsung was gooder at software. We've got to bring this energy to every phone, or we've got to back off and allow manufacturers some leeway for how they're updating and supporting gadgets. It's so obvious when it's like so heavily weighted, the concerns on one side, but then, Samsung's fine though. They really support their gadgets. Sorry, I'm so way off the chat. I'm so sorry. From Gormlord, fall asleep on your phone and tell me it doesn't get super hot. Well, I feel like, you know, if you plug up all the fans on a laptop, you know, it's probably going to perform poor. Oh. From Gabaletta, I mean, I think it's a better strategy for people. This is why I've never traded in my phone. I can always go back and reference how good or bad my previous phone was. If you have the means, I would really highly suggest getting one phone generation ahead. And by that, I mean, you lose out on this magical resale value, but if you can go, you know, one phone and then a year newer and then a year newer, you can always fall back on a phone. I think it is so critical to have a backup device. Our telecommunications gadgets are so mission critical to life in the 21st century. You want a phone that can be a backup or a weekender, right? I'm not going to take my fancy Duo 2 out with me to the beach. But when I go to the beach, I've got a rad little Pixel 4a. I've got an S10e. I've got my Pixel 3a, which has Android 12 on it. I've got some great phones that I can take with me to a sandy area full of seawater that if I kill this phone, I'm going to be bummed, but I'm not going to be totally, lacking any communication. I'm going to have something that I just pull my SIM card out. Hopefully it wasn't soaked in salt water, and I can pop it back in my nicer phone and I can get on with my life and then pick up maybe another just weekender or a backup phone as needs be. McCorker in 3. I use my 888 to cook hot dogs. I mean, it could work for that. You can put up like some tin foil, get like a little solar kind of setup, something like that. You probably get it above room temperature on an 888. And Streamy Boys. Again, this is what kills me. 865 is still rocking and rolling in my LG G8X. If you're on a Snapdragon 855, you have a laptop-grade computing device. If you're on an 865, you have one of the best balances of high horsepower and consistent performance. That 865 is only going to win in a handful of very select tasks. The 888 is going to beat it in almost every test I perform, in almost every benchmark you can perform. But the 865 just rolls. You want to shoot tons of 4K video? It kind of just goes forever. You want to play games for a really long period of time? It just kind of goes forever. You have a lot of data concerns. Like, again, the modem and the radios on 865 phones are noticeably poorer performers than what's in the 888, but they kind of just go forever. So rarely have I ever had to really manage my use on an 865 like I do on an 888. I pick up my OnePlus 9 and the cameras on a OnePlus 9 Pro rock. They are phenomenal mobile cameras, but I also know I'm really only going to get about a minute or two of 4K footage per clip if it's 90 degrees outside. And then I go and pick up my V60 and it kind of just goes. It will eventually thermal throttle. It will eventually shut that camera down, but I'm not thinking about 1 to 2 minute clips like I am on my OnePlus 9. Completely different. There is so much value to understanding your own needs so that you can buy products that satisfy those needs and you're not overbuying because you're afraid of what kind of performance you might be missing. And that we are not getting across in the tech community at all. Most of your needs are probably satisfied by a Snapdragon 845 or a Snapdragon 765. If you're a nerd like me, I can handily say most of my needs are well covered with few compromises on an 865. When I took my last road trip to go visit family, most of the work I did, I got done on my V60, not on my OnePlus 9 Pro. The only thing that really stuck out for me was 5G connectivity in my parents' sort of more slightly rural up the mountainside, their new house. I needed the OnePlus 9 for the better radios, not the extra horsepower. The extra horsepower was actually a detriment. My V60 did most of the work. because I needed that better consistency. The radio connectivity, that's where my V60 kind of let me down. That's the kind of conversation we need to be having. It's not better or worser. It's not Geekbench score bigger than other Geekbench score. It's not iPhone nerds comparing Metal GPU scores against Vulkan GPU scores and then patting themselves on the back for having a bigger number. It's really getting in there to say, like, what is it that you do? Because if you look at your list of apps, you should be able to pick a phone that perfectly fulfills those apps. Not, but what if I need more compute power? What will I do? Do you need more compute power? Because if you do, then you're probably already able to answer that question. Like, this is why tech reviewing is such a dumpster fire right now. So I love this. Aditi Anil, I gotta pick on him here. I never update my phone. My Nokia 3310 is still running launch day software. That's a lie, because we can all tag Aditya. I believe Aditya is now a member of Team Sony Xperia. So don't let him get away with that. I need everyone to call him out on that. Aditya! And McCorkran, yes, every single one. The Mi 11 Ultra, S21 Ultra, OnePlus 9, my Vivo. This Vivo is such a beautiful phone. And it runs really well, but you know what? When it doesn't cook itself, it's often performing slower than a Mi 11 or a OnePlus 9. So we're restricting some of the performance to make it a better battery life and a more consistent performer. That is a tangible consumer benefit. It's not this scary deal breaker FUD machine because the Geekbench scores lower. That makes it badder. BS. It's all BS. DTA, yeah, you do feel low-key validated when I praise an 865. Because I believe that's what you're on right now. Aditya, darn you, calling me out on stream. Yeah, because those phones still rock. Any of your Snapdragon 855 phones, your V50s, Galaxy S10s, I mean, those phones still crush. They're so stupid powerful. It's insane. It really is. We're throwing away so much compute power. And acting like I need to have the bestest, most performance-evative phone, and that's what I deserve. And what are you doing on it? Show me what you're doing on it, because otherwise you've got, like, you know, a hyper exotic V12 engine, and what you needed was a Toyota Corolla. Come on, I mean, it's just driving me crazy. Dave, 865 is garbage. Only 898s are worth it. It's the only voice I can come up with to express that comment. Absolutely, the best thing about the resale market of Android is you can get amazing flagship to your phones for like no money if you're willing to be a generation or two behind everyone. That's the last point we're going to wrap up, because I'm running crazy long on this. If you're not interested in buying a Pixel 6, you need to be critically excited about the base model Pixel 6. Not out of some, like, you know, loyalty to Android. What Google has done, undercutting the price of phones like the Galaxy S21 FE, launching the Pixel 6 at the price that they did, with Google's promise of 3 major operating system updates and 5 years of bug fixes and security patches, is going to rock so many other manufacturers for that longevity. Wait a couple months, pick up a Pixel 6 used, refurbished at some kind of cost savings. Wait a whole year, and maybe you can kick $100 off that price just because of how Android phones devalue, and you'll still be in line for 4 more years of security patches. That's huge. Imagine older Pixel 6 is going for $400, somewhere in that range. What $400 phone are you gonna put up against a Pixel 6 next year? This is crazy competition. This is the long term. This is the long con, right? This is the way out there. I know consumers want to get 3 or 4 years with their current phones. Average consumers are not flipping their phones every year. They're not flipping their phones every 2 years. The average is closer to 2.5 years, which means more people are trying to hold on to their phone for 3 years than are trying to flip their phone every year. That's what average means. So when we get out to 3 years and you can pick up a Pixel 6 next year at a reduced price and still expect 4 years of security patching, that's the gig. That's what makes this disruptive, and that's what makes this interesting. And so now every other manufacturer, Samsung's going to step up their game. Apple's already, you know, working back. I mean, iOS updates for older iPhones are basically just bug fixes at this point. You're not getting new features on an iPhone after 4 years. You're not getting new features on an iPhone after 2 years. Can confirm, I used to own an iPhone XS, and man, was that phone neglected by Apple. So this is now a benchmark reset, what we should demand from Android. And this gets phenomenally more interesting once we look beyond the first week that someone's had the phone. That means so little to me right now. This is the recommendation that I want to extend to family and friends. Like, you're telling me you don't play games on your phone, you kind of watch some videos, you need just sort of a point and shoot, decent enough camera, and you want gooder speakers? What? A Pixel 6 next year is going to be really tough to ignore, even amongst all of the fantastic mid-ranger phones that are going to come out alongside it. This, to me, is, like, I just got goosebumps. I'm all Twitter-pated about this. So, let me just take another quick sip, and we'll land this plane, we'll bring it in. without an 898 triple plus, I refuse to even countenance a phone. I can only imagine that with a very Atlantic accent and pearls for clutching as you express your attitude on this. Yeah, seriously. So Dustadora, I'm on an 855 with my OG LG G8 with no issues. Not only no issues, I pick up a V50 and there's so many things the V50 got right and that other phones have kind of walked away from. The form factor, the microphones, the processing. I mean, it's such a tank of a phone. It's so good. And if I could get the V60 camera sensor on a V50, that would be really sweet. But LG doesn't exist because techies are lame. So, why don't we go ahead and close this down here? Oh, Gary the Fireman, Google giving me 215. Sorry, Google giving me 215 to trade in my Pixel 4 XL. That's not bad. I almost want to tell you to hold on to it though, if you can. If you can afford that $215. Okay, so you go to a Pixel 6, you trade in your Pixel 4 XL, and you got $215 off. But I almost want to say, if you hold on to your Pixel 4, what replacement phone could you buy for $215 if anything happens to your Pixel 6? I spent $180 getting my S10e. So, I mean, you can do it, but I'm also, it's already your phone. And you took care of it, and you know what state it's in, and you know how the battery works, and you know how everything functions on it. If you can spare the $215, this is so much phone for $200. I mean, this is an insane pocket computer that can still beat the Pixel 6 in a couple of benchmarks. Like, well, first of all, video rendering in PowerDirector, because the Pixel 6 can't do it. So if you want the best deal and you're going to do the trade-in and 215 and that does it for you, I'm not going to say don't do it. That's your cash. But I just, when we really try and add everything up, I mean, how much phone you can buy for $200 is just, it's just crazy. And so holding on to it maybe makes sense. And again, just how great would it be if you're a weekender? It would be a bummer if I broke it, but you know, I can kind of do whatever I want to it. Phone was a Pixel 4 XL. I mean, that is a monster weekender, casually destroy it kind of a phone. It, like, oh, I don't need to worry about babying it as hard because my nice phone is a Pixel 6. Sorry, I said I was going to end this thing, and here we go, another 10 minutes. So why don't we go ahead and end this now? Oh, Gary, you're saying I may hold on to it. I may hold on to it. This would be the first time I'm not. This would be the first time I'm not holding on. Flipping phones is a very delicate art that I am not good at. Obviously, because I run a mini phone museum of older review devices. But you know, I would maybe say, like, if you were on a Pixel 5, flip the Pixel 5, get the trade-in value, and then buy a backup Pixel 4a. You know, one of those older mid-ranger Pixels as your weekender phone. But if the Pixel 4, which is already demonstrably more powerful than any of the phones in between it and the Pixel 6, the Pixel 4 is significantly more powerful than a Pixel 5, but the Pixel 5 gets better battery life and has the 5G. When we're talking about a backup phone, that's tougher. I would say, yeah, get, you know, flip your Pixel 5, get your Pixel 6, and then go back and get like a Pixel 4a. As your backup phone. Gary the Fireman. I have until December to decide. The Pixel 6 Pro won't show up until December. F it, it stays with me. We did it. No trade in. No trade in. Oh man, that's so funny. Woo! Okay, I feel like we really accomplished something now. We're going to close this down. Folks, thank you so much. I needed this to start my week off. It was a really busy week last week and really, really heavy weekend. If you're a parent like I am, you have a younger child, I would highly recommend having some of those frank conversations with your doctors and your pediatricians. I got my booster and it laid me out for a day and now I feel great. We got Lex her first shot and we're now feeling on the road to, you know, allowing her to go out and do more things in public. And we're planning going to a restaurant and maybe eating indoors for the first time in almost 2 years. I want, you know, have those conversations, take care of your family. I want to reward and congratulate the kinds of people that watch my stream because I know you're good tech neighbors, and I know that more often than not, you're just good neighbors in general. And I feel like for the 2 years that we've been through recently, that deserves a lot of credit and a lot of attention and a lot of thank yous that you might not always get in your daily lives. So take care of yourselves. Look out for each other, check in maybe on some old friends. I've got some friends that are really struggling and I'm trying to find ways to reach them. And it's hard. I mean, it's really difficult. You know, I got my shot and it shut me down for a day and I felt like I came back to a week's worth of work because I was out of commission for 24 hours. This stuff isn't easy and it's casually simple to say, but it's really difficult to operate. So, you know, make sure you're working, make sure you're okay, and then see if you've got a little energy left, a little fuel in your tank at the end of the day to help someone else out too. So I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with all of your technology. I want you to be awesome with all of your technology. I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. And I guarantee you it won't be a 2-hour and 45-minute podcast next week. So there we go. Thank you so much. And thank you all for the support and the subscriptions and the sharing and the contributions on the subreddit. This stuff is really keeping me lit up, especially as we're getting into the holiday season and holidays are stressful too. So take care of yourselves. I want to catch everyone back here next week. Be well. Be safe. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.